Tonight on The Download, we reload the news with Chicago Magazine's Carol Felsenthal and Chicago Tribune's Ray Long. From the film Signature Move, Brian Hagelke and Sari Sanchez. And from KNPR in Las Vegas, Terry Kaufman. Now, here's your host, a man whose signature move is a mix of closing his eyes and flailing, Justin Kaufman.
That's much nicer than I would call it. Flailing and closing eyes. But hey, everyone's got to have a signature move, right? It's Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 10 o'clock or so tonight. We still haven't figured that out until the Cubs game is over, and True Blue will take over from there. Tonight we start our post-game series. Of course, doing the post-game for Chicago Cubs, the run to the World Series. Tonight they are in Washington. True Blue, Mark Carmen will be in studio. Kevin Powell out at the old park, Washington, D.C. park, the name of it. We'll do that after the game is over. So up until that point, we've got plenty to do here on the Download, so we'll do it. The Week in Review, of course. We'll reload this week's news. What's the biggest story? We all know that. But we'll also get into the overreported stories, the underreported stories, the winners, the losers, which stories took us down the rabbit hole, and, of course, which story is going to be remembered years from now. Again, probably know that one as well. So we'll do that coming up. Speaking of Las Vegas, Carrie Kaufman's going to join us tonight. The journalist who used to be here in Chicago, she spent decades here. She was writing for she was covering theater and the arts for Performing. She went back home. She grew up in Las Vegas, and she took a job as a host on a show called State of Nevada, which is on KNPR in Las Vegas. We talked to her on Monday, if you remember. You're listening. And she talked about the shock of her city. She talked about the closeness and the community that come out of this. This was very fresh at that time. And, of course, it's still fresh. But today, being Friday, we thought we'd check back in with her again, talk about how her week went. What a week, from the president coming in to the continuing investigation to all eyes in the entire world on the city of Las Vegas. We'll talk with Carrie Kaufman about the first responders, the victims, the interviews, the day in the life of covering her hometown, Las Vegas. So that's coming up here. We'll do this right after the news. Or no, actually, we'll do it right before the news. How about that? Also tonight, Brian Hagelke will be here. We'll talk about his new film, Signature Moves, which is it's actually at the Music Box. It's being extended. It has played, Pete, this film that's the Chicago-made film, which really is about, it's a love story set on the backdrop of wrestling, Lucha Libre wrestling. This film has been shown in, I think it's like 88 film festivals in the last 2 years or a year. It just is like everywhere. And it's making its Chicago debut. It's at the Music Box. It got extended. And it's been in all the papers. I mean, it was a big deal this week and as it played at the Music Box. But we'll talk to them about the film, making it here in Chicago, and what the expectations are for it coming up here in the 7 o'clock hour. So we got a lot to do tonight. And like I said, we'll be doing True Blue, which is our post-game show. Mark Carmen will be in studio. I'm not sure. Is Andy Mazur coming in? I think he is, yeah? Kevin Powell out in D.C. So we got a lot to do to wrap up the Cubs game one of the NLDS out in Washington. So tons to do tonight on this rainy night. It's raining. What is this? You know what? We're getting closer and closer to this rain turning into sideways, ugly rain. Right today, when I actually came into the office today, it was kind of like misty. And I was like, oh, this is so nice. This is like a 65-degree mist. You know, I felt like I was just too close to the produce section in the grocery store. I was like, oh, feeling a little something on my shoulders. But you know, this exact storm, this kind of storm, is going to show up in a month's time, and it's going to be the windy sideways rain kind. The October winds are going to claim this storm. Coming up. So yeah. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier, Roger Badish tonight. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break and we'll come back. We'll talk with Carrie Kaufman. Sound good? Stay with us. It's a Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up a little bit later, we'll talk with Brian Higelke about his new film, Signature Move. We'll also reload this week's news with Chicago Magazine's Carol Felsenthal and Chicago Tribune's Ray Long, both veterans of the Reload segment, 312-981-7200. We'll do that coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. And like I said before, we will bring you postgame from tonight's Cubs game with True Blue, where I'll be here with Mark Carmen, Andy Mazur, and Kevin Powell, who's out in Washington, D.C. Well, on Monday, we had a chance to catch up with an old friend, Carrie Kaufman. Kaufman, no relation, used to run performing here in town for years until she moved back to her hometown, Las Vegas, to become a host producer for the talk show State of Nevada, which airs in Las Vegas on KNPR. Carrie talked to us about the shooting and what was happening on the ground. This was Monday, what she and her local colleagues were seeing. Well, it's been a tough week for the city of Las Vegas, and as President Trump declared during his visit, the country will never leave Las Vegas' side. As the week went on, more and more stories of heroism and tragedy emerged as more and more victims and first responders opened up about their experiences. So I thought it'd be appropriate to cap the week by bringing Carrie back on the show tonight. Carrie Kaufman, welcome back to The Download.
Thank you, Justin. Nice to be here.
Yeah, good to talk to you again. So, you know, this is something that, you know, we talked to you on Monday, which, you know, obviously is pretty fresh at that point, a week of covering this tragedy. You know, not only is this one of the worst, you know, shootings in modern American history, but it's taken its toll on the people of Las Vegas. Talk about what's happening on the ground there locally as this week wraps up.
I think that at first a lot of people were walking around feeling numb. I know I was, and just doing our work, trying to figure things out, help people as best we can, give blood, write stories, what have you. And the last couple of days, I think people have started to realize the magnitude of what happened. And first responders a couple of days ago held a press conference, their first press conference, and it was pretty heart-wrenching, some of the stories they told. We've been talking to other first responders and nurses, trauma nurses, about what happened at these places. And I have not had an interview with any of these people without a tear being shed.
You know, on Monday you talked about the closeness of this community. How has that concept evolved as the story becomes less about, and I guess it becomes, you know, more about the investigation, meaning, you know, who the shooter was and why, what his motives were, and less about the people. Talk about how that concept has evolved from Monday to now.
You know what? I don't know. Maybe from my point of view, the first couple of days were all about who's the shooter, what did he use, how, you know, what was the timeline, what are his motives? And that's, I feel like that's going to get answered in time. We got all the answers that we could get right away. And now the stories are coming out more and more about people who were there and their experiences, the experiences of first responders and what they saw, people who were driving by and just picking people up and taking them to the hospital. You know, we had a woman on our show this week who went in, picked people up, took them to safety, went back in and found a man who had been shot in the chest and threw him in her car. And took him to the hospital, followed an ambulance, actually, so she could get through all the red lights. And he is alive and he is recovering. And we checked in with her a couple days later, and she was having trouble with the trauma that she had gone through in saving these lives. And then we had people reach out to us and say, we want to help her. Can you give us her contact info? And that, to me, says that's how Las Vegas is. It's a weird thing in Las Vegas because I feel I said the other day that we're hard on the outside and soft on the inside. It's a tough town in some ways, but boy, when things happen, we're always there. We're there.
You also talked about, you know, there's obviously a split between the tourist parts of Las Vegas and all of the activity that happens on the Strip and then the town of Las Vegas, the city of Las Vegas. You know, when you live in the city of Las Vegas and the area, you know, I don't know if the right word is trauma or what is the emotion when you lock eyes with somebody or you're in a situation where you're talking to your neighbors or friends that this happened in your town?
Right. And there's a lot of overhearing conversations and then joining in on the conversations in the grocery line. There's a lot of, you know, I've been talking, trying to talk to people who are uncovering the story, you know, the first mm-hmm. responders and the cops and what have you. But it's been interesting meeting all of the national media that has come here for this story and are starting to recognize each other now. but it's, you know, I don't, this place, it's a lot of what I see is on social media. And sometimes I see it. There was a rally yesterday on the streets as we were coming home. It looked like a bunch of high school kids with flags and Vegas Strong written on their trucks. And we have had vigils every single night, and there's going to be another one tonight and tomorrow.
Do you see Las Vegas getting back to normal? There was a story I read. I forgot it was one of the national papers. Just about by day three, you wouldn't know that there was a tragedy in some of the casinos because it was back to the same old, you know, the bells ringing and the casinos being filled and people, you know, there for gambling and vacation.
Yeah, I asked somebody that last night who works in one of the casinos that was not affected, and he said the same thing, that the people are there. The freeways aren't as jammed, so people aren't really driving in. For this weekend, I'm hoping that changes next weekend when we have another big concert, although it's indoors, with Janet Jackson coming in at the Mandalay Bay. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping that things pick up next weekend. But I think that one of the things that I find interesting is that this is a city that is defined by the light. And the light on the strip is sometimes annoyingly glaring. But as I've been coming home every night this week, and it's been dark out, I've noted that the light on the strip is dimmer. Like the runners are on. It looks like any other American city. It looks like Chicago at night when business is closed. But the big blaring lights are off. And that, I think, is like one of the most classiest tributes I've seen thus far.
You know, as investigators widen their search for more information, I heard a clip today where they're telling people in Vegas, you know, if you see something, say something. They want to find more information about this. And I've read a couple articles, as many people have. There's been so much about Las Vegas, but just about sort of the strip culture and the people that work on the strip, that they don't easily open up about the secrets of the town or what they know, because mm-hmm. frankly, they're trained not to. That's part of, like, you know, you keep your head down and you don't ask questions. You just do your job, especially when there's money involved and things of that. I mean, is that part of the culture of Las Vegas? The idea that it is this strange contradiction that people want to open up and be together and have this closeness, but at the same time, they're almost trained not to.
I don't know. I think that in this case, there may be people who noticed things. I talked to one woman in Reno who was visiting and actually staying next door to the shooter. And in hindsight, she was like, yeah, I wondered. I talked to my husband about, why does he have the do not disturb sign on his door the entire time? Shouldn't he be out having fun? Why is there a cart in front of his door? And I think that the casinos are going to be, the resorts are going to be talking about why was a cart left in front of his door for 3 days? You know, why didn't we question some of those things? Do we have him on video bringing in bags and bags and bags of suitcases, whatever? So I think that it's not a matter of people not wanting to say something because it's a quiet culture. I think it's a matter of people just not really being aware that was something that they should be watching out for.
As you wrap up this week, which will have an indelible mark on your life and the lives of the people that live with you in Las Vegas, I mean, how have you viewed the work and the life that you've had to lead in the last week? I mean, when you think about the emotion that goes into it and everything that happened, what's your takeaway from this week?
My takeaway is that I'm really proud to be a journalist, and I'm really proud of the team that I'm working with. It's an interesting thing when this happens. At first you just go into, I gotta go to work mode. And for the first 2-3 days, I was pretty numb and just going after the facts and going after the facts. Yesterday I interviewed the person who was in Reno who who ran from the shots and could feel them whizzing by her head. And that kind of broke me down a little bit, especially when she started talking about her kids. And then today I was interviewing first responders and trauma nurses, and that this is when the numbness is worn off today. Maybe it was just because it was Friday and I was expecting it, but it's been kind of an emotional day.
Carrie Kaufman is a host producer for the show State of Nevada on KNPR. She used to work here in Chicago. She joined us on Monday. She joined us again today. Thank you, Carrie, for taking some time out to explain what's been happening in Las Vegas in your life and the lives of your neighbors. Thanks.
Thank you, Justin.
Thanks, Rob. It's Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 8 o'clock, Ray Long and Carol Felsenthal will be here. 312-981-7200. We'll reload this week's news. And, of course, coming up a little bit later, we'll have the postgame for tonight's Cubs-Nationals. The True Blue, that's what we're calling it, True Blue. Mark Carmen, Andy Mazur, Kevin Powell out in D.C. We'll have all of the highlights and break down what we see from Game 1 of the NLDS in Washington. Well, the Chicago-made movie Signature Move has been playing this week at the Music Box. It's getting good reviews, and because of that success, it has been extended. The film is about two women who start up a romantic relationship and deal with the complexities that come from it, including dealing with families. And it all takes place against the backdrop of wrestling, the Lucha Libre variety. Signature Move premiered at South by Southwest and has played all over the world, including over 100 different film festivals. It's currently being extended at the Music Box, running till the end of next week. In studio tonight, one of the stars, Sari Sanchez,
Hello.
And one of the producers, longtime New City publisher, Brian Hegelke. Brian, good to see you. Sari,
Hello.
Nice to meet you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Brian, I don't take you for much of a film producer. I've known you for a long time as the publisher of New City, great publication here in town. How'd you get involved in movie film production or producing?
Pretty much the same way I got involved in the magazine business. We just decided it'd be fun to do it and did it, you know?
How do you decide to make a film?
It's a long story, but when we started New City when we were in our very early 20s and never really thought about it being something we would do very long. And we could have easily done this instead. I mean, it was that whimsical. And so it was always something that was in the back of my mind. And you get to a certain age, you're like, all right, I got to start figuring out what I'm going to do with my life, you know?
Well, so. talk about why this film. If you're, it's one thing to say I want to start making films. What was it about Signature Move that grabbed your attention?
Sure. So when we decided to make a movie, we didn't want to do one that I wrote or tried to direct, you know, because that would feel like a big vanity project. We wanted to find something that was written by Chicagoans, that could be cast with Chicagoans, that could be shot here and do post production, everything here. And a lot of things came our way. And what happened was, we had a couple false starts, a couple things we thought we were going to do that didn't happen. And then we got this script, and it was like, oh, this is what we're looking for. Because there were two things about it, that we didn't want something that was like a genre movie. We didn't want to do a horror movie or something like that, which is what a lot of people think are kind of the way to go to Fat City in the movie business. But we also didn't want it to be super experimental and weird. You know, we wanted something that was accessible, that a lot of people could relate to. And but being New City, it also couldn't just be like, I don't know, you know, dudes hanging out at Wrigley Field. So this movie
this is much better.
Yes. You know, so when we got this, it wasn't, you know, like we put out a call saying we're looking for a Pakistani Muslim lesbian Mexican wrestling movie because, you know, we didn't know there was such a thing until this. But it was exactly what we were looking for.
Sari, let me bring you in here.
Yeah.
How'd you get involved in this film? What is it about the script and the part that you play that resonates?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's co-written by two women. There were a lot of women involved in this film. A female director, Jennifer Reeder. It was co-written by Fazia Mirza and Lisa Donato. And, you know, I auditioned for quite a few things. And this was different just because there were so woman-centric and all the women were so well written, and my character in particular was sort of this sensual, interesting, loving, confident business store owner, sister, daughter. She was all these things, and it was so well written. It was so fun. smart and so different. You don't come across a script about a Pakistani and Mexican, you know, love story in Chicago. I mean, everything about it was so appealing and so beautiful. And it was an easy yes, and certainly fun to film.
This film, of course, as you've mentioned, both of you mentioned, it's shot in Chicago. It's a story about that takes place in Chicago. But it is funny because you mentioned you don't want to do a film about guys hanging out at Wrigley. And almost all the time when there's a Chicago film, you have to have those iconic places in there. You got to have hot dogs and Wrigley Field and other things. So talk about the idea that this wasn't that kind of script. Even some of the places that you do shoot, it's great to see the bungalows that are there or in the trailer, the scene where you guys meet is in the hideout. I mean, there's something great about the idea that you're using some of the less traveled iconic places.
Yeah,
in Chicago.
Absolutely. I mean, Chicago is so much more than Wrigley Field and hot dog, and I think that's what we all wanted to do, was to represent parts of Chicago that are not often represented, South Asian neighborhoods and places like Little Village. And there's a large demographic population of South Asian people and Mexican people in Chicago, and it's not something that is represented. So it was super fun to be able to shoot in those neighborhoods. Teddy Alvarez, who plays my mother in the movie, when we shot at our home, what is supposed to be our home in the film, she grew up right across the street. And on break, her mom was very lovely and very shy and sort of didn't want to come on set. But we went and had dinner there. And, that's where she grew up. And it was just really, really great. And we really shot, makeout scenes in South Asian markets where aunties were very curious about what was going on behind the lentils. It was really fun.
The film signature move is at the Music Box right now. It's playing. It's actually been extended. And as I mentioned, it's played to over 100 film festivals at this point. It's in its infancy, this film. Brian Hagelke and Sari Sanchez are in studio. Let's do this. I'll take a quick break. We'll come back. I want to know about the film festivals, and let's also talk about the plot. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
All right. In studio, signature move. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here, 720 WGN. Talking about the film Signature Move, which is at the Music Box right now. It's been extended through next week. In studio, producer Brian Hagelke, who's the longtime publisher of New City, and actress Sari Sanchez. She's one of the stars of Signature Move. Let's talk about the plot. This is a comedy.
Yeah, it's a comedy, which I think has been so attractive to a lot of festivals. It's a lesbian comedy, and, there's no violence, nobody needs to be saved, nobody gets physically assaulted, and...
Except on the wrestling match.
right, except the wrestling. There is wrestling.
Right.
But all in good fun. But the story is of a Pakistani lesbian woman who is living in Chicago. She's a lawyer. And one summer, she meets a Mexican bookstore owner at a bar. And it's sort of their journey in the summer. And, you get to meet Alma is the name of the woman I play, the Mexican woman. And you get to meet her family and her relationship. It focuses with her relationship but with her mother. Mm-hmm. And Zanib, who is the other woman, it focuses on her relationship with her mother and how those cultures are different, the Mexican and Pakistani, and how similar those cultures are too.
Well, it's really interesting, the idea of the complexities around religion, because really that has a lot to play with how people view the relationship, whether they're cool with it, whether or not the women who want to tell their parents about what's happening will tell it when they hide it. And there's a lot that goes into that.
And culture and first generation. And, I think I know that a lot of people have related to the film because at festivals, so many people have said, oh my God, it's so great to see myself up there. But essentially, these women meet. It's based off of Fazia Mirza, who's the producer, star, and co-writer of the film. Her story of one summer, she fell in love with a Mexican woman, and they found out how much they have in common, those two cultures. And their love sort of takes its course over the summer, and there is a lot of lucha libre involved, which is that, there is lucha libre here in Chicago, and the underground scene and how queer friendly that scene is. And so it's really fun and lovely. And it's not just about their romantic relationship, but everybody grows in the film. And again, there's just so many women, and Jennifer Reeder did such a beautiful job of capturing the so much texture in the film. I think that's one of
how much as an actress, how much did you know about the Lucha Libre scene, the underground wrestling scene?
You know, I knew about it just because I have family in Mexico, and you know, I have actually been to one match here in Chicago, so I learned a lot over the course of the film, but I knew a little bit about it, probably more than the average person, but not as much as someone who participates. But it's so awesome, and the fact that, you know, we had real female wrestlers in the film and also a terrific stunt team, but the wrestling scenes are freaking awesome in this movie. I mean, they're top notch.
Brian, one of the things I mentioned at the top, I mean, 100 different film festivals that premiered at South by Southwest. That's a lot of film festivals. I mean, this film is what? How old is this film now? 2 years? Three? Not even?
South by Southwest was in March, so that was our world
premiere. You're talking about 100 film festivals. Talk about that process. I mean, it's amazing to me. I mean, I just assumed it was longer because it doesn't seem like there'd be that many film festivals from March to now. So talk about how you get into these film festivals and just the life of Signature Move through these festivals.
Sure. And some of those festivals are bookings but have not yet happened. I mean, I honestly can't even keep track of them because, you know, they book you and then you try to look it up on the web and they haven't announced it yet. And so, you know, it's just sort of this sort of constant flow. But, you know, for us, the big thing was getting into South by Southwest, which is sort of one of the big four American film festivals. And it was, you know, and once that happened, it brought us to the attention of a lot of people who, you know, wanted a film like this. There's, you know, sort of this circuit, if you will, of LGBTQ film festivals. And, you know, once this film kind of got the early recognition, we became kind of a must-have on that circuit. And there's one in every city in America. And we've done really well. In fact, the biggest is in Los Angeles, Outfest, and we won the Grand Jury Award for the best U.S. narrative feature. Right. So that's been a big part of it. The other piece of it is kind of we call the mainstream festivals, like South by Southwest. There's one in New York called BAM Cinema Fest. There's, you know, in every major city kind of has one. And we've done well in that festival circuit, too. So we've had both of them. And then I think because of the story, that it has big international appeal. So it's been playing all over the world. It's back in India this month for the second time. It's played in, you know, London. Everywhere in Europe. It's booked in Brazil and Mexico. And, you know, it's been in the Faroe Islands. I mean, everywhere. I don't even know. Like places
and
I've never
been. Is it about exposure? I mean, to play all these festivals? I mean, is that the name of the game for this film, is to get exposure? What's the end game for Signature Move?
Well, you know, the end game is still down the road a bit. But, you know, the value of the festivals is twofold. Some of them pay us a booking fee, which is very helpful to build kind of a revenue stream. It's a very challenging time to be an independent film right now. And the other thing is certainly they build exposure, especially in the markets they're in with audiences. And those are kind of your early fans that will support the film as it goes around. Now we're in a theatrical phase. We're in Chicago. We're opening in New York. We're kind of, you know, it's a very DIY thing. So it's like we're doing it, slow and steady.
I love it.
And then, you know, the semi end game is that come last day of February, it'll be on Amazon Prime. It'll be streaming. But, you know, between now and then, at some point we'll launch it on, you know, iTunes and DVD. And then there's the whole international part, which is still fully TBD.
And then there's I love that's the end of the sentence. And then there's the whole international.
Well, because, you know, we still have all the international rights. We have not done anything with that at all.
It's an amazing, I feel like we can talk for hours just about how film works and the way that you can distribute around the world. My last question for you guys, you know, this being the premiere of the film in Chicago at the Music Box. You guys shooting it here. It's a Chicago-made film. What's it mean to you, both being Chicago-centric, to have this film at the Music Box this week?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, how cool. Everything about it is so great. I mean, the Chicago talent, it's all Chicago talent. It's all Chicago crew. It's wonderful. I mean, to be able to create art that matters and is important and is fun with a community that you've grown up in, were born in, and work with your colleagues. It's everything. I mean, it's so important, especially now.
Right.
on our opening night, that theater is the biggest theater in the city by far. It seats 720 or something people. We sold every seat to our opening night screening, and the audience, you know, was laughing and celebrating. And then at the end of the film, they gave us a standing ovation, which was just amazing. I mean, that's like your dream, right? You do this Chicago thing.
Yeah, it was amazing.
You get into your dream theater, you sell it out, and then you get a standing ovation. Yeah, right. It doesn't really get better than that. It was a wonderful experience. And, you know, hopefully people will – what we're finding is – that it has its core audiences, but it reaches well beyond that. And there's guys like me, you know, straight white guys in their middle age, you know, that are loving the movie. Mm-hmm. It really does speak a universal language. And so we're hoping more and more people will see it and spread the word.
Yeah, and everyone here has a chance in Chicago. We got extended another week. That's
there you go. So it's going to be
exciting.
On stage till the end of next week at the Music Box. The film is called Signature Move. The producer in studio, Brian Hagelke, and the actor, Sari Sanchez. Sari, Brian, thanks for coming in, and congrats and all the
Thank
success
you.
For Signature Move. Appreciate
Thank you,
it.
Justin.
Thanks so much.
All right, here we go. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you tonight. 312-981-7200. We're going to reload the news. Lots to talk about tonight. We'll talk about the biggest stories, the winners, the losers, overreported, underreported, what stories took us down the rabbit hole this week, and, of course, which story is going to be remembered 5, 10, 15, 500 years from now. Ray Long is here, of course, the veteran. We have two veterans from the Reload days here. Ray Long, investigative reporter, Chicago Tribune. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
And Carol Felsenthal, one of my faves, a political writer all over town, but also Chicago Magazine columnist. And you're still writing for, is it Politico?
Politico, The Hill.
Yeah, you do them all.
Yeah.
I love it. Carol, great to see
anyone
you.
Anyone that'll take me. I love it.
All right, so let's get to it. Tonight, of course, you know, I think we're all, I mean, the whole world is unanimous that this week's story is the mass shooting in Las Vegas, this biggest story. There's a lot to unpack with this story. Of course, you know, has it been being done all week in newspapers and on television and every here on the show as well. What do you think of this, Ray? I mean, this is the people are saying and disputing it, but people are saying this is the biggest mass shooting in modern American history.
Well, it's hard to find anything else. I mean, it depends on how far back you call modern, I guess. But this is just a horrific crime. It's just a horrific, unexplainable event. And we don't know yet what truly motivated this shooter. He just all of a sudden changed and killed and really... Just, yeah, it's so sad.
It's hard to even talk about.
Yeah.
Carol, what's your take on this? I mean, obviously, horrible story. There's a lot of side stories that have come out of it, and we'll talk about that, the political side of it. Some of the very interesting stories I read about guns and gun control and everything in between, but a horrific story to be the biggest of the week.
There are few new aspects that are emerging, but there's some. And the interesting one I was listening to in the taxi on the way here was the thought was that he had committed suicide, and now the thought is that he maybe didn't commit suicide, that he had planned an escape route for himself. Mm-hmm. And he was seen with prostitutes. It looks like his girlfriend might have been right that he wired her the $100,000 in the Philippines because he was planning on ending the relationship, but not ending his life. I find one of the real, you mentioned the political aspect of the story, I find that fascinating that the right wing really wanted this guy to be a secret Muslim, and they wanted it to be an ISIS-inspired attack, and they can't leave that alone. If you go to the Drudge Report, there are always headlines on Drudge. Now, the latest thing is this guy liked to take cruises. I've never been on a cruise, and I never plan on going on one, but I know there's casino action on cruises, so it makes sense that he went to the cruises. Yeah. Some of them went to the Middle East, so suddenly there's some kind of terrorism, ISIS connection.
You know, I mean, we've heard a lot, and very thoughtful writing on both sides of the on your political spectrum about politicizing. That's been the buzzword this week, about politicizing tragedy. Many, you know, come out, even the Chicago Tribune, John Cass came out, said the left was so quick to politicize this. Sean Hannity was all over. I mean, there's so many different big time voices on the right that were really calling out the left for just making this an agenda item for politics.
But I think that was an attempt to preempt in some way. I think that any time there is some massive problem that is really bad, the other side, the left or the right, is looking toward the other to blame. And so when they're going after each other, at each other's throats like that, it just creates this whole spin of confusion and fallout that's really predictable.
Yeah. Carol, I mean, that's part of it. I found it's a head scratcher, and one that we talked about even on this show, just the idea of whether or not when's the right time to talk about guns and talk about politics or anything that has to go with the tragedy. I mean, this was almost became the secondary story about when is too soon.
Well, I don't think there is a too soon. I think that the question of gun control is it's the obvious time to talk about it. And I think, in a way, the NRA comes out a winner, not to preempt the winner part of this show, but becomes a winner because the NRA has kind of maneuvered the usual gun control Democrats into saying that we can get the NRA to agree on, what do you call that,
device?
The bump stock, which turns a semi-automatic weapon into an automatic weapon. Then you hear the audio of his shooting. It's just devastating. You have to listen to that.
Yeah.
So I thought that gun control should have been on the agenda. And this idea that we should all be thinking about the victims, well, of course you're thinking about the victims, but you want to take some kind of action. It's a natural reaction, and it shouldn't be one that John Cass or Sean Hannity or any of the other people who thought we should just pause and wait. President Trump among them, some time.
I will say, on the other side too, this idea of using bump stocks or the idea of automatic weapons. There's a lot of what I found from this week, which really was a big part of the news coverage, was a lot of misinformation about what is banned, what's a gun law. We'll talk about that. Oh, yeah. But just everything about it. I mean, military-style automatic weapons, in most cases, 99% of the time, are illegal.
Right.
In this case, he was able to modify them. I mean, he broke the law to modify these guns.
It's mentioned all the time by the right-of-center people that this device was approved during the Obama administration.
Politicizing it, right.
But,
right.
This ban on automatic weapons goes back to the days of Al Capone.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, and then there's something to be said about trying to, I think we all agree when, I think there's also some, I don't want to, the word's not evil, but this sort of divisiveness in saying that people are politicizing things. Mm-hmm. The idea is, in some of the columns this week, you saw people say, I can't believe the left is politicizing this. Shame on them. And it felt like I think that America has come together in a way, right or left, to be like, everyone believes that this guy should not have military-grade automatic weapons. It's not a right or a left thing. I think we both fall into stereotypes about, the left is not looking to put flowers in, like they're hippies in the 60s trying to put flowers in barrels of guns. And there's not a call to take all guns away from gun-owning people. I think we all can come together as a country and say those kind of weapons, please, those should not, even soldiers, right. A lot of soldiers this week in the news saying, those should not be in the hands of non-soldiers or anyone who's not fighting a war.
We've come through this as a country to decide, like Carol was saying, back to the days of Al Capone, that we should not have automatic weapons. So when you start bringing these weapons up to speed so that they're just short of that or can be modified to that, we ought to be able to say, hey, wait a second. We stop this. We don't think this ought to go forward. There ought to be a line, but that you get into that whole argument of, well, this will be the first nose under the camel's tent that could create a whole new effort to ban guns altogether. Well, that is not the case. You've seen that actually in Springfield. It played out where you could only get around the peripheries of the core issues of whether to ban assault weapons or to allow weapons without any restrictions at all. You couldn't get to that core, but you could only get to the peripheries of it.
Yeah.
And so we're just at that time now that we have to recognize that there is a point where you have to draw the line.
Ray Long, Carol Felsenthal in studio tonight. We'll take a quick break. 312-981-7200. We'll come back. We'll start with our winners and losers. I mean, the story of Las Vegas, of course, will permeate tonight in all categories. We'll talk about it. But there are some other stories from this week that we'll get into as we reload this week's news. Stay with us. We're reloading this week's news. 312-981-7200. We'll get to the winners and losers. Carol Felsenthal and Ray Long in studio. Of course, we have a lot to talk about when it comes to the mass shooting in Las Vegas. There's other stories as well. When we talk about winners, I'll start with my winner. You know, I thought that the president, President Trump, was a winner on Las Vegas. I mean, I also have him in a loser category in Puerto Rico, the towel throwing incident.
Yeah.
As much as that, and John Williams has a great point on this. He's like, that's it. Okay, the optics were bad, but move on. Like, it wasn't that big of a deal. That whole press, everything there that he did in Puerto Rico, talking about it's not as bad as Katrina and all the things he said in the moment, that I got everybody really, really scared about what was going to happen in Las Vegas, or at least me. I was worried he was going to do that kind of thing, and he didn't. He was very presidential. He stuck to the script.
Yep.
He did a good job. He had a great line where he said, we're on this country, the world is on Las Vegas' side. We'll never leave your side. I forgot the wording of it. I thought that was eloquent for him to say. And honored everyone he needed to honor. I thought it was very presidential for him, so I've given him a win in that category. The other win that I thought was that I thought that the police, the sheriff's office in Las Vegas, Sheriff Lombardo there, has done a great job with press conferences and I would assume a very difficult situation where everybody does want the answers. And he's up on stage, been very forthcoming. They've been very open and transparent. And more importantly, they haven't shown that traditional disdain for the media.
Yeah, but the media has been respectful. Yeah. It hasn't been like a Trump press conference where everybody's trying to get him. There's just not enough information to give out, and everybody is kind of panting, waiting for there to be something that connects something. I think the girlfriend, they've got to stick very close to her because it makes no sense, no common sense whatsoever, that she wouldn't know something about what this guy was up to. And I think you're beginning to see a little edge toward that. But the fact that there is no motive, and the fact that the guy had no online footprint, is that possible, or handprint, or nose print, whatever you call it? You know, where is he? Was he operating under an alias?
Right. I mean, at this point, when we talk about smaller incidents like the shooting in San Bernardino, they were trying to unlock cell phones and they were moving things. That's where we were. This is different in the way that you're right. I mean, there's
totally
really
unsatisfying. Yeah. The most interesting aspect I find of this as a person who writes biography is his father, the bank robber.
Right.
The fact that he had years in Chicago and that he was on the FBI's most wanted list. So much of the news is right out of a novel. Fiction writers can handle this stuff, and this is part of it.
Yes. What I call this is, when I'm doing a story, I'm trying to find the ever elusive why. Mm-hmm. And that is exactly where we're at as a nation right now. We just can't figure out why this happened.
The other story that we didn't bring up, and I guess doesn't really fall into the winner-loser category, but one is that, you know, we found out that this the shooter, he rented rooms at the Blackstone during Lollapalooza.
Yes.
That was a big Chicago connection, and I think that really kind of spooked a lot of people. You know, because there's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people that were down. The Chance the Rapper show that was on that Saturday was bigger than the Cubs rally.
Right. And Justin Kaufman was there, too.
I was there.
And Malia Obama.
And Sasha, I think,
thank
too.
You.
Maybe.
Thank you for putting it in the right order. Justin Kaufman first, Malia Obama second.
But
because you were whining about that earlier.
But how do you protect yourself? We were talking about this during a break. Millennium Park is ringed by high-rise buildings, and you have the people who go to the Shell and listen to classical music. You have all kinds of events there. Yeah. How do you protect
that? If you start going down that rabbit hole, I mean, that's every venue. I mean, you could go to venues in New York, Central Park. You can go to venues in L.A., the Hollywood Bowl. You know, there's places that are up in the hills there. Chicago, you can go down. I mean, you start getting to a point where, I mean, that's that we kind of talked about earlier in the week, but that thin line of, just civilization.
Right.
Where, you know, you can break that like that. And there's probably not a lot. We almost rely on each other as a community and a civilization that can't happen because there's really no safeguard against it.
Right. And, you know, my reaction when I heard about Lollapalooza is, well, the right is not going to make this argument that he selected the country music concert because country music fans tend to be white and they tend to be conservatives. And there probably were a lot of Trump voters. Right. But Lollapalooza is a totally different.
Well, I mean, that goes back to our need to know the why and the motives, mm-hmm. that there has been a lot on both sides of the aisle we've seen people getting fired. I think there was a CBS executive who got fired for making it political, saying it was Trump fans, or even on the other side, the idea that maybe this was someone against Trump people. Or I mean, here we are again politicizing the mind of somebody who there says no motive and no evidence to show one way or another the way he felt.
Right, and using this criminal as your vessel to get your message out is a really twisted way to do it.
You know, he did have a doctor, and I'm wondering why there hasn't been more follow-up on that. I've seen the doctor's name, something like Dr. Winkle, something like that, who was prescribing Valium to him. I'd like to know, and the girlfriend saying that he would lie in bed and scream, which is pretty disturbing.
Yeah. All right, 312-981-7200. Let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue winners because we'll make a transition to another big story this week that, I mean, just overshadowed, of course, but the cleanup in Puerto Rico became a very political firestorm. I mean, it was a firestorm over what happened over the weekend with the mayor of San Juan, but then also the trip as the president went to the island. We'll talk about that story, and, of course, we'll also talk about Mitch Trubisky and the Chicago Cubs, two big sports stories as well. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. All right. Reloading this week's news. Ray Long, Carol Felsenthal. Carol, longtime political columnist in Chicago Magazine, also writes for Politico and The Hill. Ray Long, investigative reporter at the Chicago Tribune. We're breaking down this week's news. We're in the winners-losers category. We'll wrap up on winners and move to losers. 312-981-7200 if you want to get involved. Ray, you and I both have on the list sports. Chicago sports in general.
Right.
This week had a big week, sans the Bulls. But you've got the Cubs who are playing right now in the NLDS, which is a great story. Mm-hmm. It rarely happens that a World Series champ can get back to the playoffs like this. You've got Mitch Trubisky, Bears fans finally getting their wish as the number two overall pick gets to start on Monday Night Football. How great is that?
Right.
And then last night, the Chicago Blackhawks, they scored 10 goals in their opening season debut against the Penguins, the Stanley Cup champion.
It was amazing. I mean, I was just kind of flipping around the dial. There was a hockey game. I watch it. Next thing I know, they've got 4 goals before the end of the first quarter, and then or first period, and then they have another goal. They got 5 goals before they shut down for the first break. It was unbelievable. And, of course, the Cubs are just a great story here. We've seen three straight years where they're in the playoffs, and this one, after they started so sluggishly at the beginning of the year, and then they've really ginned it up, and now they're go Cubs, ready to go again.
And then Trubisky.
Trubisky is amazing. And you just laid it out there, though. I mean, you know, the guy has the franchise tag on him the minute they traded for him, and he is the guy that everybody's waiting for. Is he the savior now of the
a lot of pressure
Bears?
On a kid starts on Monday Night Football.
Seems pretty mild about it.
It's actually a great, I mean, we needed it. The Mike Glennon experiment was terrible for the Bears, but it's a really great thing to have this kid open up on Monday Night Football. It guarantees national exposure. It guarantees a national story. ESPN will be all over. They already are. Mitch Trubisky will be a headline. It puts the Bears, even for a fleeting moment, into the national spotlight.
Even if he just does well and doesn't do stupendously and doesn't flop, It's a good thing for Chicago.
All right, let's get to this story is our transition because it's both winners and losers, and it has to do with Puerto Rico, a story that was obviously overshadowed this week by the mass shootings in Las Vegas. But we started with the weekend, Carol, where there was a tweets back and forth with the mayor of San Juan. Then the president came to Puerto Rico on Tuesday, did not a great performance there, off the cuff, making jokes, saying things that seemed to be out of left field. Didn't have a great performance in Puerto Rico. You have for your winners, and then we'll make a transition to losers, the mayor of San Juan, who ended up being his political nemesis on this story.
And she took him on, and she never backed down. She's a 5-foot-tall woman who was educated in the U.S. She has a degree, a bachelor's degree from Boston University. I think maybe she ought to run for president. And I think one of the big stories about Puerto Rico is how little mainland people know about about Puerto Rico and about people don't think they're American citizens. And I think there was a racial element that Trump let loose when he said they want others to do everything for them. They don't want to do anything for themselves. And she just, she just talked right back to him and wore that T-shirt that said "People are dying." And then she switched to another T-shirt that said "Nasty" on it because it was a repeat of Trump's put down of Hillary Clinton. And I thought he made a fool of himself when he was tossing out those rolls of paper towels. I found that disgusting. I thought, well, at least it's not toilet paper.
Yeah.
But it was really just disconcerting.
Now, on the other side, you'll hear people say that once again, whatever Trump does, the left will jump on the mainstream media. They're trying to knock him down, because there will be some that will say that it is very difficult. It's an island that lost a lot of its infrastructure. An island, it's hard to get to the inlands. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a job for FEMA, for everybody involved.
Right.
It's not something we could. It's not by the lack that we're not trying. But, I mean, they're obviously the optics of the president getting in front of this and making this a political argument and doing it in the way he's doing it is not helping his cause.
Oh, absolutely. And there are many things going on. I mean, I saw tweets coming out that said, well, we were able to supply Germany during the Berlin airlift, and that was a massive undertaking for years and years. And so what is the problem here with Puerto Rico? Why can't we get more help here? Why can't we put more military support in, et cetera? And so the other thing that was striking about this, and I deal with social media probably more than I should, but I was watching it because it was such a riveting story. The mayor, as you were talking about, Carol, she's portrayed in pictures out wading through water, looking for people, looking for her own citizens. Mm-hmm. They're trying to figure out where they are, and she's like chest deep in water.
In water that's got excrement.
Oh, yeah.
Really, not I know where you're going.
Talk about nasty.
And right. Juxtaposed with the tweets coming from the clubhouse where Trump is golfing. It's just optics.
Right.
I'm of the person, just like John Williams, when he's throwing the paper towels, I get what he's doing.
Right.
I get the idea that he's playing to his crowd. That people love him there. So he's helping out. He's in a moment. I understand when you take that out of context and you pull it back. The optics are just awful. He needs one of his producers from The Apprentice to be with him at all times and be like, that's not a good shot. That's not a good look.
Yeah, like,
don't tweet from the clubhouse.
Where is Kellyanne Conway?
Right.
You wonder. I think that's right. Because,
Mark Burnett.
Because if you did a straightforward evaluation of what he did, FEMA has done pretty well in Puerto Rico.
Right.
He hasn't been in the other Florida and Texas and Louisiana. Those
I don't think
been
you
successes.
Would have. I mean, obviously, it's a much different kind of disaster than Florida and Harvey. It's not landlocked. It's a difficult situation. I think Americans understand that. I think the optics get in the way when you get in these political infightings and it's cheap. It starts to seem cheap, and then what are we doing?
But 9% of people on that island have electricity after all this time. Think about how they're suffering. What do people do about dialysis? What do they do about keeping their insulin cold? Mm-hmm. What do women who are having babies do, or people going through chemotherapy or needing? It's when you think about those details, it's something that I just can't imagine having to live through.
All right, let's talk about some other losers. One that's today's loser, which I'm floored by, you guys, is the Cook County commissioners lining up and changing their vote on the soda tax, essentially having an override for what would be a President Preckwinkle veto.
Yeah.
This thing is dead. The coming up on Wednesday, we'll vote, and in 6 weeks, I think that's what Chuy Garcia was saying, it'll be a six-week runoff, that this soda tax, this fight that has, I mean, it was amazing. I was reading today, $13 million was thrown into this debate in radio and TV ads and print ads and publicists and all this. Both sides dropped over $13 million into whether or not we should tax soda. What are we doing?
We should be taxing political ads, probably. Yeah.
I think Tony Preckwinkle could come up with another way of raising that $200 million.
Right.
But I remember when Berrios was running against Claypool, I think, for assessor,
right.
And I called Tony Preckwinkle, and I was so naive, I thought she would say, oh, I'm going to support the reform candidate, and she just cut me off. She's a tough woman and difficult to interview, and she cut me off, and she said, I'm a Democrat, I'm supporting Berrios. I mean, she is, in a way, a machine politician, and she's extremely stubborn, and she has been, in many ways, a very good head of Cook County government, and I'm glad that she's staying there instead of trying to move up to something more glamorous. Remember, at the convention, she was seated next to Bill Clinton.
Right.
She's a respected person, but she needs to move away from the soda tax.
She does.
It's too expensive.
I know. It is. It's the penny per ounce and all of that. Everything in it is combobulated. They discombobulated. They messed that up in the way they rolled it out.
Yeah.
But I will say, as someone who watches this, I'm just following my gut on this. You know, she made a case for how the county needs money, and she made a case for the fact that there is an obesity problem in our city, in our country, in the world. Mm-hmm. And this is a chance for us to eliminate, or not eliminate, but at least take that on. And I love the idea that the next argument was, and if we can do that, then our hospitals will have less people in intensive care and the costs will be down. This is a saving measure over time, and we will get some money. We're going to treat this like we treat cigarettes or however. I felt like for how many times I've heard an epidemic, the obesity, or if it's opioid, whatever it is, there's an epidemic. We always will shine a light on it, but no politician comes up with a plan to address it. And Tony Preckwinkle did that. It's not popular. And to watch the Cook County commissioners go, oh, this is not, which light is the most popular? I'll go over here. It's just spineless. All of it's spineless. Stand up for what you believe in. She's doing it. She's going to be wrong. She's going to lose. But the idea that Commissioner Garcia knows he's going to run for mayor in 2 years, and he doesn't want. He voted no, or he voted yes.
Well, he voted yes.
Yeah, he voted yes, but now he's trying to get. It's just like, oh, it's so gross. I need a shower after watching that today.
Yeah, but Tony Preckwinkle, I did an interview with her for a piece that I wrote for Chicago Magazine a few weeks ago, and she was being disingenuous. She should have said, "Look, we really need the money, and this is a great side benefit." These sugary drinks, it's a class thing too. It hurts. It's such a regressive tax because the people who drink more of that stuff, I never let my children have a soda until they were probably almost old enough to drive. I mean, I really think that's the worst kind of drink to have, but people drink that, and you go to the beach, you walk on Oak Street Beach during the summer, you see plenty of 2 year-olds.
But I guess my point is, Carol, is okay, I've been told by society and different places that this stuff is bad for you. Doctors line up and they say this stuff is bad for you. So someone's peddling bad stuff.
Yeah.
And the idea that it is a class thing because 2 year-olds and 3 year-olds are drinking this stuff.
Right.
Like someone needs to step up and say, yeah, I understand. And I'll get the text saying, nah, we don't live in a nanny state. But at a certain point, you're like, I do like that the politicians are like, that can't happen because I'm old enough to, or I guess I'm of a class of person where I'm like, I'm just not going to drink it.
Right.
And I actually feel better. You know, I didn't go get my Dr. Pepper every before every show. I'm like, oh, okay, well, I'm not going to do that because of the 80 cents that's on top of that. It worked for me. I'm not giving it to the county. I'm feeling better. I'm healthy.
You wean yourself from it, and Diet Coke isn't good for you either.
No.
But that's also taxed, and the drinks that are made by your barista at the sugary drinks at Starbucks, they're not taxed. It was not well thought. It wasn't planned.
I agree with you there.
And it wasn't rolled out
well.
This is beautiful logic. But it was horrible politics.
Yes.
And so we've got a tax here that has one thing that is placed on. Instead of a broader tax on many things and say, you know, if we she just bumped it up a quarter cent or something like that,
right.
She would have had people mad and she would have had comparisons to Todd Strozier and you're going even worse than Todd or something like that. But instead, she put it on this one thing and everybody notices this. And there are so many people who are just insanely wildly upset about this too.
And I wonder how much of that has to do with a campaign. And really, you can make the argument that the American Beverage Association did a great job of mobilizing politically to get their message out before the county could get theirs out or
and
the pro people,
Mike
right?
Bloomberg
before Mike Bloomberg comes in, but that's
million.
Politics, right? You understand
right.
that? Yeah. But I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not sure if this the idea that people were mad because they had their soda tax. People don't like taxes. There's
right.
property taxes, any tax. If there's any 10 cent, 15 cent, 20 cent, I don't like it. I'm never going to be like, I like it. So I don't buy the idea that people were mad as hell because they were being taxed.
But they were
They got sold. They got sold by the American Beverage Association.
They did.
This is, they're trying to take your money. They're trying to take your guns. Soda.
It's a lot of money because if you buy 2 6-packs of Coca-Cola.
Yeah, it's $2
it's
or something.
Sure.
Yeah,
right. Sure. It's a lot of money.
Absolutely.
To me.
Yeah.
And I can
I
could totally understand why the American Beverage Association, who makes money off of that product, would be very upset and would want to mobilize and lobby against. Because of that, $2.60, Carol, that's the point where I'm like, I'm not drinking this anymore, and they're losing money doing so. Mm-hmm. They're not, you know, they're losing. So it's less. It's not necessarily about the government should stay out of our. They're also being a little disingenuous. This is their product.
Oh,
they
sure.
want to make money on.
Yeah,
it.
Nobody
sure.
is pure in this.
No one's pure in it. All right, I'm done. I'm off my sofa.
Wait. Could we have one more second?
Yeah.
So when I was a kid smoker, when I was 16, I used to be able to go to Kresge's, which is a five and dime in the city, and put a quarter into a vending machine, make sure nobody's watching me because I don't think I'm supposed to buy, and get a pack of Marlboros.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
25 cents.
There you
right.
go.
Think
there
about,
you go.
Think about that. 312-981-7200. All right. So we'll take a quick break here. We'll come back. We'll do a real quick. You know, actually, what I'll do, Pete, if it's okay, let's just keep on losers and then we'll do a double break. Does that work? Since we only got like 2 minutes here. Or should we go to the break? All right. We'll go to the break. Carol Felsenthal, Ray Long with us. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll continue with losers. Stay with us. It's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. We're just talking about the soda tax. We're going to move on. But before we do that, Rob, you want to join in the conversation. What's your thought on the soda tax, bud?
Well, I had two thoughts on it. The first being, I think it unfairly targets those in the lowest to the poverty levels. As a middle-class worker, this was the straw that broke the camel's back. I go to Indiana now, and not to buy soda, to buy all my groceries.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no tax on food over there, and I've always known I could save a few dollars, but now with this enormous soda tax, now we do it.
Yeah.
And I'm saving a lot of money, and unfortunately, there's a lot of people who don't have the resources to do that. And those are the people that are going to get targeted.
Well, what do you think, Rob? I mean, let me ask you this question, because this is the question that I think that I asked the Cook County Commissioners as well. What's the fix? If this is to fill a budget hole, but it's also to fix obesity in this country, what's the other plan? I mean, do we...
Well, here's an example I have. They did a study a while back with the cigarette tax. And just to put round numbers on things, say Chicago charges a $7 tax on cigarettes, and the surrounding communities are at $1. But the colleges did a study, and out of every 20 packs of cigarettes they pulled out of the dumpster, one pack came from the city of Chicago.
So people just go get it somewhere else.
So you want to get that $7 from that one pack? Or would you rather bring your tax back down to a normal level and get $20 off the 20 packs?
Or perhaps it has to
be a federal. And boost economy for our own neighborhoods as well. Because those merchants that are selling them are selling more product. It helps the economy all the way around.
Yeah, I get that. I get that.
It overtakes this city way too much.
Yeah.
And people are just going elsewhere for the products.
All right. Thanks, Rob. Appreciate that. That's a good point. I mean, that's another point that, I mean, you can make for all of the taxing that's being done for any nanny state stuff, cigarettes, alcohol, fireworks.
Sure.
Like we've seen that to be, that is always the case. There will always be a neighboring state. Even if Indiana banned it, everyone would go 9 hours to Ohio. That's just the way it is. All right, so let's move on. Harvey Weinstein's on the loser category, the biggest, arguably one of the biggest executives in Hollywood with a New York Times bomb. I mean, this was a bombshell story.
And there's another one coming. The New Yorker has a piece coming. In fact, Harvey Weinstein suing the New York Times. He hired the lawyer who handled Hulk Hogan. and he's his case, and he's suing the New York Times for $50 million. And one of the really discouraging things about this is a person who looks at human nature is Lisa Bloom, who's the daughter of, she's got a famous mother who's also a woman's rights. She was just profiled in The New Yorker.
Okay, okay.
And she is working for, she represented women who were suing Bill O'Reilly, and now she's working for Weinstein. So obviously he passed a lot of money her way, and she's, you know, trying to reform him and bring him back. And he was holding fundraisers for Hillary Clinton. And I don't want to sound like I'm stuck on the older Obama daughter, Malia. Obama. She interned for ours.
Well,
you know, and people knew that this guy was a creep. They've known him for years. Vanity Fair, it must have been 15 years ago, did a Harvey Weinstein.
Well, I saw a Fox News piece today that said the hypocrisy of the left, where they're like, hey, you'll go crazy writing about O'Reilly or Roger Ailes, but you're not going to write about Weinstein. But yeah. I don't know. I feel like they are. It's equal opportunity. You know what I mean? If you're corrupt and at that level, and the stories that are being told by allegedly by these women are very specific and very real, and they're gross. I mean, they're the things that casting couches are made on, right? I mean, that's the yes. I hate to say it, but I mean, everybody who's commented on that story is like, not surprised. That's Hollywood. I mean, that's a terrible, terribly unregulated industry.
And he's so powerful that when he wants to hold a meeting in his hotel room, mm-hmm. and he comes to the door in his bathrobe and asks this woman to watch him take a shower, it's
gross.
And he's not an attractive man.
And it's all about, I mean, for him, it's, and you still have to kind of go through it. And as I think it was Ashley Judd who said, how do I get out of here without offending Harvey Weinstein? That's terrible.
Well,
terrible.
Whether he's an attractive man or not, he's a pig, you know.
Yeah.
And so
he only ends up in our loser category, so there you go. Ray Long, Carol Felsenthal in studio. 312-981-7200. Come back. We'll do overreported and underreported. Stay with us. Yes. All right, thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio tonight, Ray Long, investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Carol Felsenthal, political columnist for the Chicago Magazine, as well as contributing writer for The Hill and Politico and many other places. All right, we're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. We're going to talk about overreported and underreported. Why don't we start with overreported, right? Overreported. We all kind of agree. Rex Tillerson, the story of that came out NBC this week, saying that he called the president a expletive moron. That whole story, a strange distraction in the middle of a really, really heavy news week.
Yeah, but remember that Tillerson had said that we're talking to the North Koreans. The North Koreans are kind of off the front page, too, and they shouldn't be. And then Trump tweeted that his own selected Secretary of State was wasting
his time
by making Tillerson look like a eunuch. And, and then the story, NBC gets the story, but the most important part of it, I think, and Trump makes him go out on a very busy news day and give this press conference and he has to say that Trump's smart, but he does not deny that he called
the
Trump
whole thing,
a moron.
You know, I'm a perfect person for this, the weirdness of this story, because I caught it. I got in the car, I turned the engine on, and I heard our newscaster, Steve Bertrand, go, we're going to go to Rex Tillerson. This is a major. I was like, oh, here comes the resignation. I started thinking in my head, I'm like, man, that's a lot of people that and he gets up there, and then I'm like, what is he even saying? Like, he's like, and I love the president, and the president's never been wrong, and you know,
and he's smart.
I never wanted to lose this job, and I love this job, and he loves his country. See ya. And I was just like, what was that? Why is that breaking? Why are we doing that?
And that Mike Pence had to talk him into staying.
Right.
So it was
which they all denied. Then Trump went to Twitter and said, fake news, NBC, fake news. You need an apology to America. That was my favorite part in all caps. Overreported. I felt like the whole thing, they should have kept that behind closed doors. This shouldn't have been out in the way. It's just, it seems like a coordinated strategy.
He's finished. He's by the, I give him maybe a month or 2 months. And last night, Trump had this dinner where he had all the military top brass and their wives. I think it was mostly all wives. And they're in the White House, one of the fancy rooms in the White House. And Trump, Tillerson isn't there. Where is Rex Tillerson?
Secretary of State, right?
He was not there. Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, was there. And then Trump makes this remark about it's the calm before the storm and then won't tell anybody what he means.
That's an interesting rabbit hole, right?
Really scary.
Yeah. And there's a lot of questions of whether or not it's North Korea, that the decertifying the deal in Iran, which you have, is underreported. All right, so we have Tillerson for overreported. I have a lot more for underreported. Why don't we get to the underreported stories? One story that you had, Carol, was, and I think I would argue that it is reported mostly in social media, the story of the congressman from Pennsylvania. And the, I mean, he had to resign this week because of his text messages to his mistress were revealed by, I think it was a Philadelphia newspaper that said essentially,
I think it was the Pittsburgh newspaper.
Right. There, I shouldn't, the Pittsburgh people in the building, Rob Martier and company, are mad at me right now. Pittsburgh paper. But the point being that he had suggested an abortion to his mistress, and while he's on the floor of Congress, he is a staunch pro-life, if not the leader of the pro-life movement in Congress, trying to ban outright abortions. I mean, that's the hypocrisy at the core.
The highest level. And if you hear his speeches, which have been played and replayed, he has this saccharine voice and this holier-than-thou manner. And he voted this week for the ban on abortion after 20 weeks. That's
right.
A tough subject. I agree with that. But the guy is just so morally phony. So I thought that was the hypocrisy of that, and the hypocrisy just of the way people behave in general, Tom Price, the HHS secretary or former, taking these hugely expensive flights and not going to meetings about the Affordable Care Act, which is being sabotaged and decimated as we sit here.
Another underreported story, right? about the Affordable Care Act. Democrats are attacking the Trump administration for what they say sabotaging. And we've talked about this on this program before, but one of the arguments from the left has been that the Republicans in Congress in the last 8 years have done everything they possibly can to choke this, the Affordable Care Act, and take away its money. Now there's reports that the president is directing some of his staff in different places to I think it was in Iowa.
Not to shore up the exchanges, not to do anything to help them. A direct order from the president. Why is he even doing that? That's an issue that should not be.
It's a very, very strange and dangerous tactic to say, okay, let's just let this die, and if it won't die, let's kill it. The idea for political gain. I mean, they couldn't get the repeal and replace done.
Yeah, well, you know, this is not done on the square. You know, it's just that he's doing that for his base because he thinks he can get some more juice out of his base, who will say hooray Trump and then stick in his corner. But the one of the ironies here is that Murphy, the congressman, said he was going to finish his term, and then he gets so much pressure he just decides he's got to resign. So he's basically cutting his term short because he asked his mistress to cut her term short, if you will. It's just too much of a weird thing.
Wasn't pregnant anyway.
Absolutely, yeah, right.
Well, and another, I mean, the story there too, which is, I mean, the hypocrisy, that's the part that's the worst, but also that he didn't really believe. I mean, that's where you get the hypocrisy, that there were the text messages suggested that he was like, I just take the money because it's money and it's good for my career. I don't really care about being pro-life. Yeah. Like, and then they're just like, what's happening? Like, I mean, that is you get into the issues of abortion or we didn't even talk about birth control yet. But all these issues where you feel like ideology is at the center of it. It's not even about people. It actually hurts people. Mm-hmm. Ideology over people.
Right.
But then to find out that the congressman doesn't really care. It's just about getting money in his pocket.
He said
that changes everything.
When his mistress pointed out that his website is full of these strong anti-abortion screeds. He said, oh, I don't write them. My staff writes them, and I cringe when I read them. And the guy is a psychologist, and mental health is his one of his big issues besides anti-abortion. He's supposed to be the worst employer in the Congress, you know, screams at people, takes papers and throws them off his desk and says, this is unacceptable, this is crap. The guy's, you know, good riddance.
312-981-7200. All right, we'll come back and we'll get some more stories. I mean, there were a lot of stories this week. And we'll go through the rabbit hole stories and, of course, which story is going to be remembered. We know that one. Ray Long and Carol Felsenthal in studio tonight, 312-981-7200. Stay with us. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is Reloading This Week's News with Ray Long and Carol Felsenthal. Coming up here, True Blue, the Cubs postgame. Mark Carmen will be in studio. Andy Mazur, Kevin Powell out at the field in D.C. as the Cubs and the Nationals are in the ninth inning right now. The Cubs with a 3-0 lead, game one of the NLDS. Things are looking good, but yeah, Game's not over yet. All right, so let's get to the stories this week that took us down the rabbit hole. Ray, you got an interesting story that was in your paper today that really kind of grabbed your attention about it's a hard one with any story with diseases.
Oh, yeah.
Always seem to work out.
It's actually on the web right now, and it's coming out in the Sunday edition, and you just got to read this. This is a perfect illustration of why we can talk about bureaucratic bungling and what can really go wrong and how children's lives are changed because their lives really didn't have a chance to be better. Patricia Callahan of the Tribune has done a superb job of reporting in depth and put together a beautiful narrative about this disease called, and I may mispronounce it, it's called Krabbe, and it is a disease that can be detected shortly after birth. And law was passed by the state back in 2007 to test newborns for this. But after a variety of reasons that you'll just have to read about because of the bureaucratic bungling that went through it, they never really put this together. Children then caught this disease and have really had no chance. If you can have a procedure done, stem cell work done, to try to prevent it if you get the test and find out about it early. But once you get only a few months down the line, it's too late. Hmm. And so it's a very sad tale, but a very insightful piece of reporting by Patricia Callahan of the Tribune.
All right, we'll check that out. That's going to be in the paper this weekend. Carol, when we talk about rabbit hole, we kind of already talked about pop tax. But the other thing you talked about was, you know, the story that the media likes to portray that the president is not doing anything, that he's a failure, that up to this point he hasn't done anything. And you actually push back on that. You know, you've written about this as well. But whether it be judges' appointments, we know the big one with the Supreme Court, of course, but federal judges, the Federal Reserve, which is coming up, a lot of different areas, the president's actually kind of in overdrive.
You know, what Trump did when he was working out of the Trump Tower in New York in the period between his election and his inauguration, when he brought all of these droves of people in to give him tryouts for the cabinet, and he hired some of the most conservative and rigid kind of ideologues to put in these important positions, such as Jeff Sessions, as Attorney General. What did Jeff Sessions do today? He weakened discrimination protections for LGBT people. This was a long time coming with fights and fights. So that's done. Then he's going to probably appoint a new governor of the Federal Reserve. Generally, the tradition is that the president, no matter what party, sticks with the person there. But I have a feeling he's going to put in somebody else. And the scary thing about it is I'm not sure he even understands what the Federal Reserve is and how it operates. I would bet that he doesn't. DACA is another issue that we're kind of losing sight in. I think it was today or it was yesterday when the expiration day hit. And now we know that what Trump is doing through his appointed people is he wants to put these draconian limits on immigration in exchange for helping the Dreamers. And that's going to be a very tough. Chuck Schumer, Chuck and Nancy aren't going to like him anymore because that is, you know, really picking up the hammer and using it. And he's got this guy, Stephen Miller, who I have been following closely. He is Trump's guy. He is such an ideologue. He's the one who came up with the carnage word in the speech in the inauguration. Well, Stephen Miller wants only 15,000 immigrants allowed into the country, and I think Trump's at the 45,000 level. Barack Obama had two times or three times that many. It's just, and we sit here and
so I mean, in front of, I mean, and some would argue, you know, his followers would say that's a good, this is where he wants the mm-hmm. this is what he campaigned mm-hmm. on. But the concept being that, you know, it may not be in legislative victories as it used to be, where
right.
that doesn't define a president. A president is doing a lot to reshape the country that we live in.
Yeah, right. he these are tectonic moves. These are not. Ones that presidents can do, and you have to have control of them, or you at least have to have some kind of governor to slow it down when you're going too far. But he doesn't seem to have that. And like Justin was saying, the president is playing toward his base, and a lot of them are just applauding more and more.
You know, my story is, as we get ready to wrap up here, has to do with the. You know, as much as I'm guilty of it, too, I've done it probably five times this week where I had talked about gun control and I had talked about the NRA and I talked about the lobby and paying off, you know, congressmen, things of that nature, or you can't get anything done because the lobby puts so much money in. We've heard this over and over. I mean, it's almost that's the rallying cry on social media right now. Well, the New York Post had a great story about that the NRA lobby really it doesn't put a lot of money in. There are bigger industries with, I mean, even smaller industries than the gun industry that are putting more money in. Google is a great example. They talked about the tech sector puts in triple what the NRA puts in. The food industry to lobby for different ingredients and additives and regulations or unregulations, money, federal. There's so much that do much, much more, but we act like the big boogeyman is the NRA, like they own every congressman. But they did a breakdown of who gets paid what, and it's really not. When you think about American politics, it's chump change. What they were talking about is this: they are very good at uniting their membership around the idea that we told you, here come the people for your guns, and here they come. And it works because they vote.
Yeah, and having spent many years in Springfield watching this, the big thing that I want to underscore what you said is that they vote, they mobilize, and they really believe that every type of bill that is what they'll call the nose under the camel's tent is one step away from taking your guns out of your homes. And at least they will write that up in their literature, and they get their whole base fired up. They don't worry about the nuances. Yeah. They just run it out.
It's a great story. It's in a New York Post. Check it out. All right, so, you know, the last question I ask, which story will be remembered? We know which story will be remembered, the mass shooting in Las Vegas this week. We talked a lot about it, and we continue to talk a lot about it. As the president said, you know, we'll never leave Las Vegas aside. A tremendous week and a lot of emotion involved in that story, but one that definitely will be remembered. Ray Long, Carol Felsenthal, I can't thank you guys enough for breaking down and reloading this week's news. Appreciate seeing you. Thanks
Good
for
to
being
be here.
Here.
Thanks.
Welcome to True Blue, the Chicago Cubs post-game show. We did it. The Chicago Cubs win game one against the Washington Nationals out in D.C. And the NLDS is a big win, 3-0. Big win for Kyle Hendricks and the boys in blue. The Chicago Cubs with the win. We're with you for a while here. 312-981-7200. Joining me, Andy Mazur. Andy, good to see you. A big game.
Yeah.
What's the storyline that'll be playing out in the papers tomorrow?
Well, I think number one will be Kyle Hendricks. And I think the number two will be just some clutch hitting by Anthony DeRizzo. We saw how he got off to a little slow start last year during the postseason, but this year a huge two-out run scoring double late in the game to pad the lead, and Hendricks made it stand up. So, hey, all's good. I mean, Carl Edwards goes in, pitches one inning. Wade Davis gets the save, and that's how you draw it up.
That's how you draw it up. Let's go out to Kevin Powell, who is out at Nationals Park. Kevin, a big win for the Chicago Cubs to steal game one in Washington. What's your thoughts in Washington?
Yeah, that was just about as perfect of a game one as you could possibly draw up, as you guys just said, for the Cubs. That was ideal. Kyle Hendricks gets it on Wednesday, and just – like right after Madden announced him as his game one starter, he said, I fully anticipate Kyle going deep Friday night. And he was right. Hendricks gives up two hits over seven innings. He was absolutely dominant tonight. That's one of the best offenses in all of baseball, guys. I mean, there's really not a weak link. And he shut him down. He was absolutely a stud tonight. And we've seen sort of Hendricks ascend over the past few years, where Madden was a little bit hesitant to loosen the leash a little bit, and he kind of had the early hook. Talk to Mark Carmen later. I'm sure he'll tell you all about it in Game 7 of the World Series. Kyle Hendricks getting an early hook. He's still bitter about it. Madden clearly had faith in Hendricks. Let him ride tonight, and it all paid off. He was dominant, and just as you guys said, that was about as perfect of a game one as you could have imagined for the Cubs. And, man, what a demoralizing loss for the Nationals, right? I mean, they've won the NL East for the past 6 years, and they haven't won a single playoff series. Game one at home, Strasburg delivers with an outstanding performance, and they still can't win. So this is not a good start for the Nationals. Huge win for the Cubs, stealing game one. That was an all-around great game for the Cubs. They really didn't do anything wrong tonight.
Yeah, and, you know, if you watch the national broadcast, like I think everybody did, Ron Darling, obviously a pitcher, was really complimentary of Strasburg, and rightfully so. But failing to point out that it wasn't like the Nationals were beating around Kyle Hendricks a lot, and the first team the first guy that blinked was going to be the loser, and it was Strasburg was the first one to blink.
Yeah, and you know it wasn't even so. I think both those runs he gave up were unearned, because it was Rendon's error that gave the Cubs a window. And to the Cubs' credit, they couldn't really get anything going. But as we've seen over the past few years, the more times this lineup sees a starting pitcher, the third, the fourth time around, they're so dangerous. The Cubs hitters are so good. The more they see a pitcher, the better they get, and the more dangerous they get. And Rendon let them just a little crack, a little window, and they took advantage of it. Chris Bryant with a great at bat, and you talked about Rizzo's bat in the eighth. And I know many have talked about Dusty Baker not just walking Rizzo in that situation with an open base at first and a couple outs. I don't know really what the thought process is there. Maybe we'll find out in postgame. But, this is what the Cubs do, man. This is, you know, for such a long time, it seemed like an uphill battle for the Cubs. And now it just seems like they stay calm, cool, collected. And, you know, especially after winning last year, like they talked about it this week, that winning last year, all the pressure's on the Nationals right now. Everything right now for the Cubs is essentially gravy, you know? I mean, obviously we all expect them to win this thing, but you can just tell that they've been tested and they know how to weather the storm. And they, all game long, did they not just look cool, comfortable, collected, all those cliches out there? They just looked like they knew what they were doing, and they never really looked like they were panicking at any moment, even when Strasburg was dominating on the mound.
Kevin, do you think that Dusty was going to actually pinch hit for Hendricks when he had John Jay in the on-deck circle? I'd like to see if there was maybe a bluff going on right there. Because if I was the Nationals, I would have wanted to get Hendricks out of the game there. I would have intentionally walked by as just to make them make the move. And so then you're into the Cubs bullpen in the seventh. And I wonder if there's a little cat and mouse game going on there. I thought that was a mistake by Dusty.
That's a good call by you, Carm. I think that was another moment where Dusty was criticized tonight. I think Joe Maddon outmanaged Dusty tonight. I think it's as simple as that. I mean, Joe Maddon didn't really, everything he did made sense. But yeah, I had a couple questionable moves from Dusty. No question about that. That's
Kevin,
a good point by you, Connor.
Let's do this. I know you got to go because the post game stuff, and we'll grab as much as we can, and we'll check in with you in a little bit. So go do that, and we'll check in with you once those get going, and we get some more answers, especially from the managers. Kevin Powell, talk to you soon in D.C. right now. Mark Carmen joins us.
I am so happy to see both of you. I can't believe how incredible this thing just started. What a performance. I mean, Kyle Hendricks, I'm sure that I was watching over in Old Town. I didn't expect this thing to come as quick as it came. I'm still in amazement that they just, I mean, what a performance.
Well, let's talk about it. I mean, MVP of this game, I mean, Anthony Rizzo, of course, at the plate, but Kyle Hendricks, much, I mean, really exceeds expectations. This is not what you thought you'd get from Kyle Hendricks in game one against the Nationals.
It's a new level, right, Andy?
Well, I think the faith that they showed in him last year goes a long way. And, you know, he wasn't right during the year. The tendonitis prevented him from the changeup. That's his pitch. That is his pitch. And I tweeted this out earlier. I was having a conversation with Josh Friedman over at WGN TV on Twitter. And I was always told, and Greg Maddux used to tell me this all the time in the dugout, whenever things got crazy and hectic, everybody's natural tendency is to try to throw the ball harder. He says, when you throw the ball harder, it straightens out. It's easier to hit when you try to overthrow the ball. Kyle Hendricks can't overthrow the ball and pitches like a guy that has been there for a long time. His demeanor never, ever, ever changes. And he went to what he was supposed to go to. And that's his off-speed stuff. That's his changeup, mixing in that 86, 87 mile an hour fastball. And that's why I was so upset that they were talking all the stuff about Strasburg, because he lights up the radar gun and he had 10 strikeouts. Did he win the game? No, I don't think he did.
Well, Hendrick was the better pitcher tonight. And I thought when he walked, who was hitting in front of Murphy? Rendon?
Rendon was in front of Murphy.
Yeah, so when he walked Rendon, and here's Murphy coming up in a two-run game, and this guy's killed us, and he's killed Kyle Hendricks, and he went right at him got him striking out on a pitch out of the zone. I'm like, dude, you are a confident stud of a game one starter, and I don't care if the radar gun's reading 88. This is incredible.
Who cares?
He's a stud. Flat-out stud.
Follow me on this one, because it might sound a little strange, but to me, the biggest at bat in this game was Javi Baez striking out in the seventh inning.
In what?
Because he was a number eight hitter. John Jay did not get a chance to pinch hit, and Kyle Hendricks went back out for the seventh inning.
That was exactly my point. I'm sitting there watching. I'm like, if I were you, Dusty, you want to get him out of the game.
Yeah, that was the biggest at bat of the game.
I mean, the Cubs have Strope, and they've got C.J. Edwards. Those are your right-handers in the pen.
They have Dunsing warming up.
And so even if they pitch well, you still want both of those guys to get used.
Right.
And you got him out of the game. So I thought that Dusty blew it right there. And I don't know. I don't think that Madden would have allowed Hendricks to hit, but it would have been interesting to see what he would have done. Yeah. I would have definitely made Joe Madden make a decision there.
More conversation here on True Blue. Mark Carmen, Andy Mazur in studio. Kevin Powell out in D.C. 312-981-7200 if you want to get in the action. Take a quick break and come back. Cubs win. Stay with us.
I bleed Cub and blue. That's just what Cub fans do. I bleed Cub and blue. It's all within me. I bleed Cub and blue. No other blood.
Cubs with the big win. True Blue here on 720 WGN. The post game is the Cubs beat the Nationals in game one of the NLDS 3-0. Big win. 312-981-7200. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio with you. Mark Carmen, Andy Mazur, WGN Sports. Kevin Powell also out at Nationals Park. Let's continue the conversation about Kyle Hendricks. As Kevin Powell mentioned, the idea that, you know, there's a little second guessing on the idea of Kyle Hendricks being your number one starter, game one starter. He deserved it, of course. He had a great second half. But, you know, they've got John Lester. They got Jake Arrieta. The other people, of course, with the injury. Kyle Hendricks proved tonight that he deserved this spot.
I hate to toot my own horn here. Actually, I love to. But I think we said it last week when I was on with you, Justin, that it just made sense that here's a guy who's been there, done that. He's the most healthy. He's been their best pitcher. And you know he can come back if there's a game five. So I just thought it was pretty logical that he was going to start. And then you're not going to back him up with Quintana because he's never been there. So it just made sense they'd go to Lester. And then coming back home, I'd figure you give Arrieta as much time as possible to get healthy. And, you know, blind squirrel finds another. I got that one. That's one that just made sense, and that fell right for me. But
it was tremendous. It was great effort.
Mazur dogged me on Twitter. I put it out there.
I said, is there anyone smarter than you?
Yes, and then I said, you'll be learning a lot this postseason. But he Madden alluded to Hendricks about a week before the season ended, unprompted. Well, what about this Kyle Hendricks guy? And it's like, well, and so he kind of tipped his hat that, hey, this is who we're going to go with.
I look at it this way. You know, we talk about the Nationals' hard-hitting and good-hitting lineup. I got to be honest with you. When you're a hard-hitting team like that and you hit fastballs, you're not ready for Kyle Hendricks because there's nothing straight, first of all, nothing over 90 miles an hour. And it just disrupts timing completely.
Look at these stats. I mean, because Kyle Hendricks threw a two-hitter tonight in his seven innings strong. He walked three guys. But look at, listen to this. Trey Turner, 0 for 4. Bryce Harper, 1 for 4. Rendon, 0 for 3. Murphy, 0 for 3. Zimmerman, 0 for 4. Worth, 0 for 3. These are, I mean, this is the vaunt. This is supposed to be the best offensive lineup in the National League. To see all of those offers, I mean, Bryce Harper, one of the only two hits. It's pretty impressive. And one thing I wanted to point out is that he had a kind of a bumpy ride in the first inning.
He did.
He got through the first nine hitters. He had a bumpy ride. But surprising to me, he actually got stronger as the game went on.
It's totally, you know, they went through the lineup in two innings. We weren't remotely touching Steven Strasburg. And so you're wondering second time through, is this going to be trouble? But he settled in. And to your point, Justin, as far as like, and Andy too, is the mental focus and just the way he goes about his business. There were a lot of pitches tonight that he didn't get. And
right.
Right.
A lot of pitchers would freak out. He just, nothing changes with the guy. He's just as the same guy. If things are going well, if they're not going well, it's the opposite of John Lackey, and that's two ways to
Well, you know, it's
go
funny to say that because it was a very inconsistent play tonight.
It was.
And I mean, Strasburg, he got 10 strikeouts. What do we got here? We got Joe Maddon coming to the let's bring in manager.
The last several
Joe
days, how well he's been throwing the baseball, pitching. You saw the velocity on the board. I mean, for him to maintain those numbers for the entire game is really impressive. And with that, that's why the changeup becomes an even better pitch at that point. So, yeah, that was, we took advantage of a mistake. Their third baseman's outstanding. We got lucky right there. But then again, the two-strike knocks. KB and Riz both had difficult their first four at-bats combined. And then after that, they come up with two big hits. Pretty spectacular.
So you said you got lucky there.
Yep.
Having gone through this last year, do you need a certain amount of luck?
Of course you do. Of course you do. You have to be able to cap it. Because there, I mean, neither team, we made some plays. I mean, how about Javi's catch on that pop-up? I mean, you have to make plays. You can't give extra outs. And, you know, fortunately we did not do that tonight. You have to capitalize on mistakes if they're forthcoming, especially in a game like that. Now, there's some games like 9-8 tonight and all those other high-scoring games, maybe a little bit different. When pitchers are at the top of their game, you have to score on outs. You have to, you know, make your own music somehow because it's very difficult. I mean, from the side, both those pitches were unbelievable tonight. Strasburg with that changeup now, I know he's had it, but I mean, I've not seen a lot of this guy, but that is such a weapon to go with the other things that he does. And then Kyle, like I'm saying, with added velocity, and you saw called strikes, taken strikes that the hitters knew were strikes because he was so effective locating velocity, his velocity. So, yeah, you have to take advantage of mistakes under these circumstances.
You mentioned before the game, you know, hopefully you get a lead and then you can make your defensive changes in that sense. Did this game go according to plan?
The team we had on the field in the ninth inning right there, I couldn't be happier with that defensive alignment. That was about as good as it gets for us. I mean, if we could finish every game like that, having a lead with that alignment, I'll take it. It's, but then again, you have to, I mean, like right there, I'm thinking, for instance, taking John Jay out. If they were to happen to tie it, that's Doolittle anyway. So then here comes Al Moore is going to hit, and then we'll have to do something in the next spot. So it was tonight it was perfectly put for us in regard to that and the ability to finish the way we did. Martin in left, Al Moore and Jason, and then the infield. That's, you know, that's a warm fuzzy from the dugout, man.
Go ahead, Mark.
Joe, you talked yesterday about experience and knowing. When Strasburg's pitching that way, does that experience come into play in terms of your hitters not starting to chase and sort of try to do more than what they do?
Yeah, I think some of our guys had really good at-bats. I mean, I thought Addison had great at-bats all night. I thought Jason Hayward had really good at-bats all night. It was actually the bottom of the batting order there. I mean, Schwarber, first at-bat, really good. I think the knowing is that just keep going, boys. Just keep going. Look for that little thing to occur that you could jump in there. But then your pitcher has to be, you know, in line with what their guys, otherwise it doesn't matter. And so their guy was that good, so was our guy. And then eventually you just look for the opening. So great baseball game, obviously a great way for us to start here. The fans for them were totally into it from Jump Street. It was really an energized situation tonight.
Joe, the crowd and
yes, sir.
Everything that was going on, you know, you guys had to just hang in there. And when Chris Bryant gets that base hit, did that gave the team an extra boost? And how did that make you? It must have made you feel really good.
Yeah, it did give us an extra boost. And it always makes me feel good when KB drives in a run. The thing right there, you knew that it was going to be a low-scoring game. Kyle being able to go as deeply into the game as he did really permitted us to do. We wanted to do it the latter part of the game. I liked CJ at that part of their batting order. And, of course, here comes Wade. So any time you could get that kind of a start, especially in the postseason, seven innings strong, oh my gosh, that makes everything different. Now, tomorrow we had guys warming up. Dunsing was up a couple times. Stropey was up a couple times. But that's just the nature of the beast in such a close game. Now you can't take anything for granted. You have to be ready for the next moment if it occurs. And the fortunate part is after tomorrow's game, there is a day off. David.
So you've seen Kyle as best a lot of times. How does this performance compare?
So I've been talking about, see, like last year he was, you know, obviously in the Cy Young discussion. This is as good as I've seen him. The last two or three starts. Why? Because the velocity's ticking up. He's actually hitting a lot of, I don't know how accurate their gun is. I don't know if it's a little bit hot or not. Sometimes I wonder. But if the gun was accurate, he hit as high as 91. He didn't pitch at 91. He probably pitched at 88, 87, which is good. And then he touches 89, 90, 91. But as a hitter, when he's able to do that with that movement, and then you have to honor that plus that, the changeup, it makes him even more effective. You can see his delivery, how well he repeated it, pitch after pitch after pitch. He's such a technician mechanically. And you know when he's, you could tell, I mean, immediately when he's on top of that, meaning his mechanics. And I talked to him during the course of games often about whether he's on or off. And when he's on, I don't say anything, obviously. So you could see it from the side when everything's coming together. And he really gathered momentum, I think, about the fourth inning, started feeling really good about himself.
Joe, in the back.
Yes.
Winning game, how much is that perspective for you about braving home field at the end of the game?
Well, you know, the thing about the playoffs, to me, it's I think it's overblown. Honestly, the home field advantage, like last year, for instance, we did okay in Cleveland. It's this time of the year you're playing a lot of really good professional baseball players. Now, obviously, the fans, a loud ballpark, which that was tonight, and we have a loud ballpark at home, too. But Cleveland took advantage of us last year at Wrigley. So I honestly believe this time of the year really comes down to the pitching component of it, regardless of where you're playing. So their crowd was great tonight. We pitched a little bit better than they did. I really lost this thing about the home field advantage in baseball in the playoffs. I don't know that it's really outstanding or not.
Joe, in terms of facing Gio tomorrow, what's
yes, sir.
The biggest problem that he presents for you guys?
Well, you know, he's had a really good season, and he's very tough on lefties. He's extremely tough. We've had a couple guys with not very good numbers against him. So with Gio, a big thing about him for me historically is you got to make him throw the ball over the plate. He's really into getting you to chase a little bit. So if we could really command our strike zones, that would be the probably the biggest thing we can do. He's very competitive, good guy. I've had conversation with him in the past. Very good, coming off. He's on a good season right now. I think from our perspective is to make him come into the zone. If we're chasing, he's going to have a real good night.
Okay. Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Right, there we go. Joe Maddon at the podium tonight, taking questions from the media. A tremendous game for the Chicago Cubs and, of course, Maddon. Anthony Rizzo is getting up on the podium next, but I think what we'll do right here is we'll take a break. True Blue, it's post-game for the Chicago Cubs, who won tonight, beating the Washington Nationals 3-0 game one. Of course, game two tomorrow, Gio Gonzalez, John Lester, who will talk all about that coming up here. 312-981-7200. It's True Blue. Stay with us.
Popped him up. Contreras calls, and that is a game one shutout by the Chicago Cubs of the Washington Nationals in this best of five.
Go, go, go!
Chicago Cubs win that game.
True Blue, the Cubs with a big win. Mark Carmen, Andy Mazur in studio. I'm Justin Kaufman, 312-981-7200. A little post game here for a game one winner. We'll take it, right?
Absolutely.
Ten.
Ten to go.
Yep, drum roll, please.
We just heard Joe Maddon up on the stage there talking a couple of key points. One about Kyle Hendricks. He's really liking Kyle Hendricks right now. I mean, you mentioned it before, just that he was even talking about it before the season ends, but it seems like this is his guy.
I mean, he said that the last two or three starts, he's never seen him better. That was one thing he said. And then he mentioned his velocity at least twice, maybe three, four times. So, and he questioned whether the radar gun was correct in D.C. because he's seeing 91. But the point is that he's able to hit 88 consistently, and then he can tick it up, 89, 90, when he wants it. And that makes him all the more difficult. So this is huge because, you know, you look at the rest of the rotation. I mean, who are you relying on right now? You need Kyle Hendricks to be Kyle Hendricks.
And it was interesting because when the series started and we first found out that Hendricks was going to be the number one guy, at least for the series, the negativity of my brain kicked in and said, you know what, if they can steal game one with Hendricks, okay, you've set yourself up now because Lester has had some decent outings since he's been back from the disabled list.
And he's a veteran.
Plus he's a veteran guy that's been in these situations before. Then you're heading home. So now the worst you do is go home. You're 1-1. I mean, you got a chance to wrap it up on your home field.
Now, another thing that Maddon talked about, he kind of downplayed the idea of home field. he mentioned last year we saw that in the World Series that the Indians came in and beat the Cubs at Wrigley Field. I mean, he obviously knows, but I mean, is there merit to what he's saying? I mean, do the Cubs not have an advantage at Wrigley Field?
I mean, you'd always rather be at home, right? But I mean, last year you lost 3-4 at home. You miraculously got through game 5, killed them in game 6, and then, you know, game 7, greatest game of all time. And then let's think about in the Giants series, you won it out in San Francisco in game 4, and then in the Dodgers series, Kyle Hendricks again. What are they? And they won it out there.
Yeah, they won games. Well, they won it on the home field.
They won in the home field,
but they won games out there when they needed to.
How could I forget that?
It's all good.
Walking around Wrigley Field with my phone on Facebook, having the time of my life. Where'd they win it? It's all a blur, man.
Yeah, it's all good.
It's like the new Cubs. Yeah, this is so crazy.
It is crazy.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is, too, at this time of year, every team is good. I mean, you're not here unless you're a team that can win.
Especially in this playoff. Yeah.
And you're not a team that's alive if you haven't had a winning record on the road, or at least close to .500 on the road. So nobody's really fazed by that at this point. Well, it doesn't surprise me that sometimes your teams play better on the road, especially in playoff situations, because you're not around the hype.
Less
all the
distractions.
Time. You're on the road. You're away. You're together. You've got the goal. You know what you're doing.
I mean, we were talking about Rich Cohen was in here this week, and we were talking about the pressure put on these young kids at Wrigley Field last year in the playoffs, where people were coming to the game with urns of ashes of their grandfathers. Like, you know,
it's true.
There's a curse, and we need you to do this. But when they actually had a more unified team when they're on the road. And frankly, I mean, we just saw the Cubs go on the road with 4 games in Milwaukee and 4 games in St. Louis. Yep. They were tight and they were efficient. They were the Cubs team that we expected this year. So they do play well in the other team's ballpark.
Well, and that's the end of the day why when you look at the field, you've got a great Dodgers team. The Nationals are extremely good. And then you go to the American League, the Astros look incredible. Mm-hmm. The Indians are
worldly.
Right. But with the Cubs, they just have... They've got the championship. They've proven time and time again that they don't fold when it's, you know, when you think that they will. It's like it's the anti-Cub. You got to believe in these guys. It's unbelievable.
Well,
it's unbelievable. You got to believe. Does that make any sense?
Well, let me ask you this, because Carm, I know you watch the games like I do, and just, you know, obviously Justin, you're doing a show. It's hard to watch the game and do your show at the same time.
I've got two eyes.
Yeah, I know you do, but you know, you're a pro, so you worry about your show.
Right.
But I remember Carm last year, and I know you have trouble remembering where they clinched the NLCS, but just the feeling in your stomach watching the game. I didn't have that burning sensation that I had all of last year, and I think part of the reason why I didn't, starting with tonight, this is not the best team in baseball, so to speak, this year. There's no possible
collapse.
It's just right? it's a situation too weird, and I think maybe a lot of Cub fans feel this way as well. You got your championship. I'm not satisfied. I don't think a lot of people are.
Did the Cubs use that to their advantage, the fact that there's so much hype around the Dodgers and the Indians and the Astros that this year they can come in and just play?
You just do your thing. You just play your game. And I didn't see one guy out there. And remember all the struggles Rizzo had early in the playoffs last year?
That's true.
And the same thing with Addison Russell, who had mountains of problems during the early parts of the series in last year. You know, Javi Baez, okay, yeah, he swung at some pitches again tonight that, you know, you'd like to see him not.
Right.
But again, the guy makes great plays in the field. So they have been here, and they have done that, and they have accomplished what they, you know, want to accomplish again. But I don't know, Carm, did you have that feeling still watching the game tonight?
I mean, I was, you know, when the game started and the Cubs went 1-2-3 in the first, I was on, you know, minor panic mode. Of course, I, you know, thought about hiding under the table for just a brief second there.
Which he did a lot of last year up
right.
in Studio A.
But, you know, when you have success in life, when you do things a bunch of times and then you actually start having success at it, you're going to gain confidence. Mm-hmm. I can do this. I've been there before. No big deal. Seventh inning, game on the line. Been a zillion times. Ground ball coming down the third base line. Oh, by the way, I picked up that ground ball in game 7 last year and fired across the diamond to win the World Series. No problem tonight. I'm going to have a ridiculous bare hand, Chris Bryant. In a 2-run game, I mean, these guys just believe in themselves, and they're extremely talented.
Let's go to Kyle Hendricks, who's up on the stage right now at Nationals Park, listening to what he's got to say.
How do you explain the added velocity that both Joe and Anthony talked about?
I think probably a little adrenaline-based, but my last 5-6 starts, it's been creeping up kind of every start. My mechanics have really been clicking, so my timing's there, where earlier in the year, my mechanics were just off, so I wasn't able to let it go. So now that my mechanics are there, it feels good. I can just let it ride, and I think that's probably where it's coming from.
Kyle, your defense played well today. Bryant, all your guys made great plays, bare-handed plays. Talk about that. Comment on that.
That's what we do, man, and it works well for me. I love those guys back there. That play by KB was huge, especially leadoff guy, Worth. We needed that one, but that's what they do all year long. You know, they put in the work, and it shows come game time. So I rely on that as a pitcher, pitching to contact. So I appreciate all that.
Kyle, Joe said this is the best he's seen you pitch. Do you agree? You think this is the best you've ever been?
Maybe not best ever, but it was up there. It was a pretty good one. I think early in the game, I was a little up. There were a few balls on the barrel. So after about the third inning, I really started dialing it in. And from there, I would say I was pretty good. My fastball command got really good. Changeup worked off it. But it helps a lot. Willie and I were on such a good page, so it keeps the flow of the game for me going. So that's a big part for me.
Good.
Kyle, that lineup's been pretty potent all year long. How does your style of pitching, especially with the changeup, help keep them off balance?
Yeah, you know, it's just going in with a good game plan. We got a lot of guys that do a lot of research behind the scenes here, so it's having good information and then going in and just mixing in and out with my fastball and changing speeds back and forth. You know, that's pitching. That's kind of what I have to rely on without plus stuff. But when I start hitting spots, that's really when it starts to take off for me. My changeup can work off that. But, yeah, I didn't throw many curveballs tonight, so really it was relying on the fastball changeup.
How much did seeing them guessing as much as they seem to be reinforce your scouting report and build your confidence as the game progressed?
Yeah, definitely. I think your confidence builds when you start seeing those swings. You know, early in the game, like I said, there were some balls on the barrel, so I knew I wasn't where I needed to be. You know, got to get the ball down, kind of refocus. But after that, I start getting the bad contact, kind of the bad takes, you know, then you know you're in the flow of the game. So from there, just keep feeling what they're trying to do to you, really. Keep mixing pitches. That's where Willie comes in. He really feels the hitters really well, too. So we work well together, and you kind of just flow from there.
All right, that's – here you go. Kyle Hendricks on the mound, the professor with the awesome game tonight, and he talks about pitching. That's pitching. That's pitching.
Can we just for a second recall that we traded a worthless, very entertaining, but worthless Ryan Dempster and scouted this guy, Theo Epstein, Jed Hoyer and company did, and said, you know what? You don't throw super hard, but we're going to bet on your makeup. And by the way, we're dealing a bag of balls, and we're going to get you for that. And this dude's going to pitch in Game 7 of the World Series. Should have won the game.
Mm-hmm. Nope. So thank you, Sam Holbrook.
There you go.
And, yeah. Okay, that's just really
Mark Garman, Andy Mazur in studio. True Blue post-game Cubs win. They get to take a 1-0 lead over the Washington Nationals. We'll continue our conversation and include you if you'd like to contribute. I got some texts as well. We'll get to 312-981. 800-951-7200. Stay with us.
Left field, that ball will get down and not get a run. It rattles around in the corner, and Rizzo standing at second in a 3-0 game.
Baseball season's underway. Better get ready for a brand new day. Hey, Chicago, what do you say?
Well, the Cubs won tonight. They beat the Washington Nationals in Game 1 of the NLDS. It's True Blues, 720 WGN's postgame. Andy Mazur, Mark Carmen here, Kevin Powell out. Nationals Park, we'll get to him. He's actually in the press room talking or listening to all the players, asking questions. All right, we got to talk about that. I mean, even what we just heard, Pete just queued up the highlights. Anthony Rizzo, Chris Bryant, all three runs. Anthony Rizzo to start tonight on the offensive side. I mean, these guys just continue to be the face of the Cubs and the guys you go to in the playoffs.
It is a flat-out shame that I don't have a Brizzo t-shirt. That is just that is not the way to live your life. The big hit in the sixth to get him on the board, and I'm sitting there going to right field because first of all, they have the shift on him, and it just seemed like there's just no way you're going to pull this guy. And then he goes and he does it, and the bang-bang playing at second, and then Rizzo comes through. These guys, that 2-3 is it's just sweet. They're young and they're incredible and they want to win.
And they feed off each other. Obviously, totally. I don't think one wants to do what the other does, and vice versa. And they're both not only offensive players, but they're tremendous defensive players. As you know, Mark mentioned earlier the play that was made over at third base, the very end.
Yeah. All right. Before we go, let's go. You know who's on the podium right now is Dusty Baker.
Dude, high fastballs. He was all quadrants tonight. You know, he can pitch. Which is evident. I mean, we only got two hits, and we didn't hit the ball that hard off of him. But, he threw a good game tonight. Strauss threw a great game, you know. Anthony, we've never seen him do that. And then it led to a two-out hit, and they got three two-strike, two-out hits. And that was a ball game. Like I said, Strauss was outstanding. He did everything he could. They got some clutch hits. And in the playoffs here, the team that gets the most two-out RBI hits is usually the team that wins. And that's what they did tonight. We didn't have a bunch of scoring opportunities. And they had three and got three.
All right, there you go. Dusty Baker is just talking about Strasburg. We wanted to hear him go, I screwed up. We didn't get that.
He sounded so old there.
Yeah, he seemed a little bit out of breath. Rizzo and Bryant, It's amazing to me because, you know, the other teams obviously have scouted them. They shift to different spots. We've seen both these players be pretty much pull hitters. I mean, in the way that they have, that's maybe their weakness in the way that they they get the shift and the teams can go against them. But tonight, both of them come through in the clutch too. And just as Dusty Baker said, two out, two strike hits, and that's the difference in the game.
Yeah, the one thing Bryant is so much better at this year than he was last year is going to right field. There was no chance of him getting a ball into right field or right center even last year, maybe by fluke. But I think this year it's more of a design. He's letting the ball travel a little bit deeper into the hitting zone, and I think he's just much more confident. I mean, this guy, I mean, you put the numbers, you match the numbers that he put up last year versus this year. Last year when he won the Most Valuable Player of the Year award, they're not very far off. They're not far off at all. They're far off in the power categories a little bit. You know, home runs and RBIs are down, but that's a product of, you know, the way that he's being pitched and also with the fact that you don't have a lot of guys on base in front of you, especially the first half of the season when they weren't scoring any runs. But he's a much more accomplished player than he was even last year.
He's a run-scoring machine, partly because he's hitting in front of Rizzo.
And he's base running.
Yeah, he's a phenomenal base runner. He's a very, very good third baseman. And just going back to Dusty and Rizzo, you know, you go back to the eighth, you got two outs and Rizzo at the plate with a runner on second. Call me crazy. I'm walking Anthony Rizzo all day. Instead, they threw him 17,000 pitches. He kept on fouling him off and finally got one that he could handle and put it down the left field line. Dusty, walk him. Pitch to Contreras. That's a no-brainer to me. I don't care who's on the mound, lefty or righty. I forget. And it was a righty too.
It was Ryan Madsen.
Yeah, it was. You had Madsen on the mound. That didn't make any sense to me either.
Yeah.
Dusty had a bad night.
Dusty did have a bad night, but we'll take it. We're okay with that. And I think there's a little part of Chicago Cub fans that are okay with that, even that it happened to Dusty Baker. Mark Carmen, Andy Mazur in studio tonight. True Blue, the Cubs postgame show tonight as the Cubs beat the Nationals 1 and go up 1-0. When we come back, we'll take a break. We'll get an update with Rob. Let's talk about what to expect for the rest of the season, and let's talk about lineups. I mean, we saw that Joe Maddon put the best players he had on the field. He had Zobrist out and right. He was able to pretty much get everybody involved in the game. Masterful performance from manager Joe Maddon tonight. We'll take a quick break. We'll get an update with Rob Martin. And we'll come back. Stay with us.
Anthony, twice you were up in the sixth and the eighth with first base open. Were you surprised that you weren't walked either once or both times? Did that give you just a little extra boost?
I'll be honest. You put guys on in the playoffs, it's just, I don't know. It's different. You got to get outs, and Wilson's swinging the bat really well. He's a threat every time he comes to the plate. He hits Strasburg really well. He had a good at-bat. He hit a ball hard. And the second time, you just don't know. You got to be focused. You got to be locked in, and those are situations I want to be up in, and thankfully, I hit the ball where they weren't.
Little Anthony Rizzo right there, who's on the podium. Nationals Park. The Cubs, of course, win game 1, 3-0. They got a 1-0 lead in the NLDS over the Nationals. Mark Carmen, Andy Mazur. It's True Blue here on 720 WGN, the postgame. I mean, even you said it. I mean, you think it's a mistake, but Anthony Rizzo says you don't put guys on in the playoffs.
Translation, I'm absolutely stunned he didn't walk me. I don't know what Dusty Baker is doing. And Joe Maddon, my manager, would have walked me. But let's hope that they continue to do it this way. So, yeah, you don't put guys on in the playoffs. I'll be honest with you. I'm going to lie to you. That was what that was, at least the way I heard it.
Yeah, it's don't give the other team anything else to, bulletin board kind
of
stuff,
right. To hear all the players up there and to know that tonight it was Rizzo and Bryant. Also, Joe Maddon talked about Schwarber's at bats, Addison Russell's at bats. Again, this team is stacked with a lot of young talent and a lot of positional strength. As we get ready for game 2 tomorrow, let's play Maddon. What do we see? Because John Lester takes the hill, much different pitcher than Kyle Hendricks, which definitely changes the way that the defense lines up.
I got my lineup. I don't think that this is how Joe Maddon's going to go, but this is what I would do. You got lefty on the mound. I'm going Ben Zobrist and right, Jason Hayward. You get the day off. We'll see you later. You overswinging like you always do. That's fine. He's had a halfway okay year. I don't need to go into that, Mazur. We don't have to redo Jason Hayward. I got Bryant, then Rizzo, Contreras. I got Happen left. I got Russell at short, Baez at second, and I got Almora in center. That's what I would do.
Okay. We differ by only one position, perhaps. I'm not going to do batting order. I'm just going to give you the field here. I've got Jay in left. I got Happen center. And I've got Zobrist in right. And then the usual suspects, Bryant, Russell, Baez, Rizzo, Contreras.
It'll be a big deal if they don't start Jason Hayward tomorrow. That'll be asked about, but it makes sense.
It's an easy out because Gonzalez is a tough left-handed pitcher. You'll take out Schwarber, you'll take out Hayward, and I really believe that you'll save Almora just in case that there's you still have the lefty on the mound for a pinch hitting appearance later in the game. Then you have to hope that Dusty, they don't have a ton of lefties. I mean, they have Doolittle, and that's, you hope you don't get to that because you hope you're winning the game.
Well, as a longtime lover of fantasy baseball, Gio Gonzalez can be beat.
Oh, yeah. He beats himself a lot.
He does. He walks a lot of guys and gives up big runs.
He can implode.
But it's surprising because I would ask the question of you guys, my only pushback on whether or not Joe Maddon's going to tinker, is this lineup produced? They got three runs and some of them unearned, of course, on an error. But the idea that why not just stay with the guns? Why not stay with Zobrist in right and Schwarber in left and keep Hayward in center? Why not just stay with the lineup that won tonight?
Yeah, because it hasn't been that way all year. I mean, first of all, I don't think guys really it used to be a situation where you could go play a wiffle ball game in their backyard and emulate whatever your favorite team was, and you knew who was batting first all the way through ninth. Not the case anymore. I think managers have evolved to the point where they figure, you know, we've got to get guys four or five at-bats in a game to have them be useful as pinch hitters in the following game, because you know, you kind of get your feet wet a little bit. You get a chance to see a different variety of pitches. You're not seeing just fastballs and sliders from guys late in games. You're getting a chance to see a changeup and a curveball every once in a while, which certainly helps. And I think these guys are good enough and understand enough that they're not – I don't mean to say they're interchangeable parts, but I really feel like there's guys that are going to be able to contribute. And there's too many guys for too few spots to be able to contribute.
We got three guys, I think, that the entire playoffs you'll see. Bryant hitting second, playing third. Mm-hmm. Rizzo at first hitting third. And Contreras behind the plate hitting fourth. I would assume that's going to happen. The rest of the lineup – I think he'll be Joe Maddon. You got me a hot on Gio Gonzalez looking at his last couple of starts. Last outing, October 1 against the Pirates, 4 1/3, 7 hits, 6 runs. Before that, 5 innings against the Phillies, lost, 5 hits, 3 runs, 3 earned. Decent outing against the Braves. Before that,
He's up and down. He also is a pitcher who runs out of gas. He's done this a couple of years. Not the ideal second starter when you're down a game, but Max Scherzer needs a space just like Jake Arrieta. Yeah, they're talking about Scherzer possibly at Wrigley Field in game 3.
Yeah, and it's the playoffs. I don't need the master of the obvious here. It's a huge game tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Huge game.
Must win.
But listen, you know that Scherzer's coming and you know that Strasburg's coming back, so you. There is, I would think, a big want to beat Gio Gonzalez, and all these guys are very good pitchers. You're going to have to earn your way, but this is their worst of their three starters, assuming that Scherzer's healthy.
Let me ask you a question about Ben Zobrist. Mm-hmm. Ben Zobrist 0-4 at the top spot tonight. Not a great performance, and he seemed to think that he had a scouting report on Strasburg. He'd swing at the first pitch every time.
Yeah.
But Zobrist, a guy who was once the World Series MVP with the Royals last year, clutch. I mean, he on paper, when you look at the numbers he put up this year, he's the guy that should be out of the lineup. But he won't be because he's clutch.
He's clutch, and plus, you know, I don't know if you'll see him leading off tomorrow, especially if John Jay is in the lineup. I think Jay might end up leading off in tomorrow's game. But the thing about Zobrist is he usually, and again, I think there was a scouting report on Strasburg fastball early because he swung at the first pitch in 3 at-bats. I think the final at-bat was more a product of trying to advance a runner and coming up empty and doing that. But, you know, Ben Zobrist, 9 times out of 10, will give you a professional at-bat and foul off some pitches.
Right.
And
you expect
give you a chance
too,
to see some of what the other guys got.
It's hard to be critical when you're going up against Steven Strasburg, but I thought that Ben Zobrist missed a bunch of pitches today. I mean, but balls that were up in RBI situations that you're not going to get much better than that. I mean, that's where you got to come through. And he didn't tonight, but – hard. Maddon loves the professionalism of a Ben Zobrist. So, but I would be stunned if Albert Elmora is not in the lineup tomorrow. Now that
you're going to be stunned.
He's had a tremendous second half.
Okay,
I think you're going to be stunned.
I mean, he against left-handed pitching, he is a go. I mean, he's been sensational. He is an unsung, unheralded player, but doesn't play every day.
He has been.
Is he ready to be trusted in a playoff game?
I mean, he had some huge moments last year.
Yeah,
the pinch run. Tag up from first to get to second.
Incredible catch in
game 7.
The Giants.
Yeah.
I think, and he's earned it.
I think he's earned it.
He's played great.
I just don't know if it's yet where Joe Maddon's going to start him. I just don't know. I could be wrong.
Let me ask as well. I mean, obviously it's situational with Gio Gonzalez, but Gio Gonzalez gives up home runs.
Mm-hmm.
And Kyle Schwarber hits home runs. Yes, he's a left-handed hitter. I understand that that's not an ideal matchup, but are you at the point where you ride the horses that got you here? He hit 30 home runs. He's had an okay second half. Kyle Schwarber, I would make an argument just based on the last two postseasons, he shouldn't be out of the game at all.
I would tell you this, and I'll tell you this is more of a defensive situation than it is an offensive situation because of Lester pitching tomorrow night, more of a fly ball, contact kind of guy. That you want your best defense in the outfield. Today you had your best defense on the infield because Kyle Hendricks is more of a ground ball, keep it in the infield kind of a guy. So I think that the lineup, believe it or not, does go through that kind of a situation where you have to think
about the defense
as well.
The
and there's not a lot of versatility when it comes to Kyle Schwarber.
And I don't think Schwarber will be out there either, Justin. But that being said, if he was out there, I mean, every time he comes to the plate, I'm excited.
Oh, me too.
Let's go. It's
I mean, the reason that we're okay with him hitting 120 or whatever he hit in the first half
bombs.
Is because you know that he's going to be a guy who come playoff time is going to be having memories. Mm-hmm. I mean, what he did in his rookie season was tremendous.
Yep. And despite the difficult season for him too, he did a
ended up with 30 home runs.
He ended up with 30, and I thought that he handled not being good very well.
I will say there's not a lot of guys in Major League Baseball who get sent down to the minors and still hit 30 home runs. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's all I'm saying. I know he had a terrible year. I watched. He had a slump year, but 30 home runs. Mark Carmen, Andy Mazur in studio. We'll take our last break with True Blue, the post game here. The Cubs beat the Nationals, take game one. They got a 1-0 lead here in the NLDS. We'll take a quick break. Stay with us.
Into right center field. That ball's going to get down, and that is going to break the scoreless tie. Baez scores. The throw to second. Bryant is safe, and the Cubs are on top, 1-0.
Go, Cubs, go, Cubs, go. Let's sing.
True Blue, the Chicago Cubs post game. We are celebrating a game one victory. The Chicago Cubs beat the Washington Nationals 3-0 to take game one in Washington. Kevin Powell's out there. We'll have him on the line in just a second as they are going through the motions of all the press conferences and everything after the game. In studio here in Chicago in the Allstate Showcase Studio live tonight, Mark Carmen, Andy Mazur, I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, so let's talk about game two, John Lester. John Lester, last year's, Cy Young, really a guy who has been there. He's won World Series with the Red Sox, now with the Cubs. He has been the rock, the anchor for this team. Tough year for him. He has not been the John Lester that we've known. What do we expect from him coming into game two?
This is why you went out and spent all the money on John Lester. Forget about the regular season. The little injury there set him back a little bit, but this is why you pay him the money. Because he pitches in postseason, and he's been a good postseason pitcher. It's a different situation here too for the Nationals hitters. I think we talked about it earlier with the fact that Hendricks not touching anywhere near 90, no matter what the gun out there in Washington said. Lester can bring it a little bit and gives you that fiery kind of an attitude that Kyle Hendricks doesn't. But this is a big game pitcher.
His last two starts, and I think it's worth mentioning because he's coming off the injury, mm-hmm. 6 innings, 5 hits, 1 run against the Cardinals, and then 5 innings, 4 hits, no runs, struck out 7, didn't walk anybody against a terrible Cincinnati team. I don't care. I thought he ended up the year exactly how you wanted mm-hmm. him to end up. And listen, this guy, the last time he was on the mound in the playoffs, was coming out of the bullpen in Game 7, and he was nails. So,
This would be... If you're looking for a sure thing on the, John Lester's the guy in the playoffs that you'd want on the, I'm not saying regular season, mm-hmm. I'm saying on the playoff, you would want to see John Lester pretty much in Major League Baseball.
And we look back
just
to last
of
year.
Track record.
Well, yeah. And then, that was the whole reason that Joe Maddon went a little crazy, in my opinion, in game 7 last year. Definitely wanted to get him into the game. I wish he would have waited another 2/3 of an inning, to be honest with you. But again, they won, right? A team goes to a ballpark when they know that John Lester is pitching and feel like, you know what? Yeah. We have a really good chance to win this game today.
He was their best pitcher last year. He won game 5 at home, mm-hmm. in an incredible performance.
Gutty performance.
And then he comes back, in game 7. Two. And the other thing is, listen, if the Cubs are actually going to do what all Cub fans are dreaming they're going to do, which is do the whole back-to-back thing. You're going to need John Lester to be John Lester. Mm-hmm. Period.
John Lester.
You can't not have it. So, and you're going to need all of them.
Let's
really do
this. Let's bring in Kevin Powell. He's at Nationals Park. Of course, the press conference is wrapping up. Kevin, tremendous game, of course, for the Cubs. What did you glean from the post-game press conferences? What did we learn about the Cubs that we didn't know already?
Well, I just think that everybody's in awe of what Kyle Hendricks has done, not only tonight, but, Carm, you mentioned his outing in St. Louis. That was a huge outing. I mean, that it wasn't exactly super tight with the Cardinals down the stretch in the division race, but that was a big game for him. And then, last time the Cubs shut out a team in the postseason was in Hendricks' outing last year in the NLCS. So, everybody was sort of just gushing over his performance, including Dusty Baker, Anthony Rizzo, and Joe Maddon both talked about Hendricks. His velocity was up today, guys. I'm not sure if you noticed that. It's been up over this past 5 or 6 starts. He credited tonight some of the adrenaline that obviously is pumping through his veins in a moment like this. But he also just said his mechanics are clicking, and his mechanics are pretty much perfect already. So if all that is hitting on the right cylinders, you're going to get a really, really good performance from Kyle Hendricks. But I think it's time
everybody starts taking him a little bit more serious. Not that we haven't, but he's certainly been in the shadows of Lester and Arrieta and even John Lackey. But he's 27, guys. It's not like he's 23 or 24 rookie. I mean, he's been here for a few years now, and he just continues to deliver for the Cubs. So, obviously, Joe Maddon was right going with Hendricks for game one. Takes a little bit of pressure off John Lester tomorrow. And basically a perfect game for the Cubs today. Even defensively, Maddon pointed to it. He's like, before the game, ideally he wanted to finish the game with the defensive layout that he had. And when you take a lead, you know, that gives Maddon the luxury to do something like that. So you can put Martin out in the center, you can shift Zobrist back over and put Hayward in right where he's a Gold Glover. So everything just about went right for the Cubs tonight.
Would you call it a super enthusiastic locker room, a business as usual locker room?
Business as usual. I can cut you off. You don't even need to give me the third.
That was it. That's all I had.
They are, man. They're totally different. It's just incredible being around them. And Rizzo talked about it, and it sounds a little cliche, but it does. You know, he pointed to, remember game one of the NLDS last year? That was a pitcher's duel. That was Lester and Cueto, and Rizzo joked that he said to Baez in the dugout, he said, "Hey man, we're gonna need another solo homer from you in this one." Yeah. Obviously, to work out that way, they caught a huge break with Rendon there, and Brian and Rizzo were able to do the rest. But you know, it's pretty wild being around them, being the World Series champs, and they enter as underdogs. John Lester talked about it. He said, "Look, there's a bunch of prideful dudes in this." In this clubhouse. So hey, you guys, Kev, can look at us as underdogs, but they don't care.
Let me ask you, was there any hints from Maddon or any of the players about what we might see with the lineup tomorrow? I mean, with John Lester on the mound, a different defensive scheme?
Well, I think he didn't give any hints, but I think we could all sort of guess with Gio on the mound, Schwarber's probably not going to start tomorrow. I'm guessing you'll probably see Zobrist in left, Hayward in right to start. I'm really interested to see what he's going to do in center because he loves Jay right now, and Jay's been playing some great baseball for them over the past couple months. He'll play the matchups. Maybe Almora in center. We'll see to start, but I don't think we'll see Schwarber in the starting lineup today. I don't know if you guys think.
Yeah, that we went over to everyone. I say he should stay in. These guys are the professionals. They say he won't be there. But let me ask you as we wrap up here. You know, the one thing about, we haven't talked about it all tonight, the Nationals, you know, the Nationals fans, there were a lot of fans. There were a lot of Cubs fans, too. You heard in the clip when Contreras caught the last out, there was cheering from the fans. What was the atmosphere there? I mean, the Nationals kind of have an up-and-down feel when it comes to their fans. I've heard, you know, earlier in the year they didn't even sell out when the Cubs came to town. How did they react to the loss tonight in Washington?
You know, it was a pretty electric atmosphere just before first pitch. It really was. Some of them were filing out. I've heard some weird stories. I don't know if you guys have heard about this, but like the public transit around here, around
just
the
park,
is, yeah, it's just down like at 11. Yeah. So a lot of people are like, okay, well, I'm out of luck if I wait this thing out. So, okay, I'll give them a little credit there. I don't think that would deter Chicago fans back home. I mean, Cubs fans are waiting things out no matter what. But no, it was a good crowd for the Nats. Yeah, it never ceases to amaze me how well Cubs fans travel. When I was in the airport, well, that was today, I guess. That was early today. Sorry, I'm losing track of what day it is of the week. Earlier today, I'm at, you know, and there's Cubs fans everywhere. There's Cubs fans on my flight out here, 6 a.m. flights, everybody getting out here. I've seen them around my hotel as well. So they travel in bunches for sure. It's nothing new. Cub fans doing what Cub fans do.
All right, Kev. Well, we look forward to getting your reports tomorrow as for game two. But tonight, good work as the Cubs win game one. Kevin Powell at Nationals Park. Thanks for joining us, bud.
All right, boys. Talk to you tomorrow.
All right. We'll take a quick break here. And we come back. Preps Plus Chicago takes over. It's True Blue here on 720 WGN.